It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
You are listening to episode 596 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off Experience. I am Hans Sala Monster. Happy Easter to those celebrating today. Happy Passover to our Jewish friends. It's too bad Hansen and Roe were passed over for a good name this week. But we got the superstar shakeup to talk about, and yes, the Montreal Screwjob. Because I know you've not heard enough about that match yet, and so I'm going to fill you in on what we kind of learned this week from the Viceland special. I shall do so in my own entertaining way to try to put a little bit of a different spin on a story that I know we've all heard 1,000 times, but we'll talk about that. But first, quick plug for our friends at Audible, who are still offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook of their choosing. I mentioned last week one of the newer wrestling-themed books that's up on Audible. It's a good read. From all the reviews that I've seen, Chris Charlton, who you may hear sometimes doing commentary, English commentary for New Japan Pro Wrestling, he provides a lot of the Japanese translations for some of the talent when they do their promos. He wrote a book called Eggshells, which is a pro wrestling book about wrestling in the Tokyo Dome, kind of a historic look back. If you're into Japanese wrestling, New Japan, want to know the history of it, especially at the Tokyo Dome, it's a great read, and you can get the audiobook version right now. Just use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Sign up for the 30-day trial. You can sample the service, and as part of your trial, you get one free audiobook of your choosing. It doesn't have to be the Eggshells book, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. So audibletrial.com/Sala Monster, and if you want to become a PayPal VIP, you can do so. On thesalamonster.com, $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. You'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. Thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Downtown Kenny Brown, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T., Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Recon Russell Bulware, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Eitan the Executioner Zimmet, and All Class Alfie Fisher. Also want to give a shout out to Kobe7K on iTunes. He's been a listener since the 8th grade. And he is now 20 years old. This is what he mentioned in his iTunes review. 8th grade, he started listening to this podcast. He's 20, which means soon you'll be able to drink during Raw, like the rest of us. So thank you, Kobe. I appreciate that. It appears that CM Punk made a very quiet return to wrestling just a few days ago. The MKE Wrestling promotion, which is run by Silas Young from Ring of Honor, they run their shows out of Wisconsin. They had a show Friday night at the Knights of Columbus in West Allis, their final time ever in that building, a building that apparently has a lot of history. A lot of people over the years have wrestled matches inside that building, and this was the final show. Now, CM Punk was in Milwaukee. He was at the MMA Academy there, the MMA gym, where he trains or has trained in the past. He even took a photo with somebody while he was in town that was posted on Instagram. And he was wearing a particular hoodie that apparently is not a hoodie you could just walk into a store and buy. So people noted he's wearing this hoodie. And by the way, West Allis is apparently near Milwaukee. It's maybe a 15-minute car ride. So yeah, he was in town. Punk was in town. Now, there was video that was posted on social media. If you watch the video clip, it's from the end of this particular match on the show. And if you watch the video during the main event, Dave Prazak, he's the one who brings this masked guy in a hoodie, which happens to be the same exact hoodie Punk was seen wearing in that photo. He's the person who brings this masked man out from the back. Prazak's been friends with Punk for years, as has Ace Steel, who's one of the men who trained CM Punk. who I believe was in the ring. And the masked man hits a GTS and then was very quickly ushered to the back. And apparently right out the back door, out of the building, and was not seen again. And the next morning, Silas tweeted out, "Last night we held MKE Wrestling in the Knights of Columbus building in West Allis. Place was packed with 350 people. This place has had 25 plus years of wrestling and is the place that a lot of guys got their start. Guys like Colt Cabana, as well as a punk who showed up in a mask last night." Now let's assume that it was him. I don't know for sure. The guy was in a fucking mask. How do I know? But let's assume that it was him. It probably was. It probably was. I know Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful, Robbie Fox over at Barstool Sports both chimed in and said that this would not be the first time that Punk has done something like this since leaving WWE. That is, showing up at an independent show, unannounced, under a mask. And it just feels bizarrely right that CM Punk's return to wrestling, for all the people who were clamoring over it for years, who still chant this guy's name at shows, it would be bizarrely right for him to have made his return to wrestling at random indie shows under a mask or in some sort of costume without anybody even knowing, in front of 200 people, 500 people. Kind of, it reminds me of CP Monk and Colt Cabana from Chikara all those years ago. I love it. You know, it's Easter weekend. Punk should have come out dressed up as the Easter Bunny. Should have been an Easter Bunny costume, handing out Z-Packs to all the little kids. But you know, if there is a masked wrestler in AEW now, you know that it's going to be nonstop speculation that it's CM Punk under the mask. So what they need to do is this. AEW finally gets going. They're going to supposedly have a two-hour primetime show starting in the fall. Okay, let's say they do. Once things really get going, they got to have a masked character with whoever. It doesn't even matter who's underneath, right? They should have a similar body type, but it almost doesn't even matter. You have a masked character. Person doesn't speak. Maybe he's even part of a faction or a group or something. Let a year go by. 6 months, a year. Let people think it might be Punk. Drop little hints, maybe. Maybe he even busts out a GTS or a move that Punk would do every now and then. But again, nobody says anything. Nobody admits to anything. He doesn't speak. Then you sign Punk. Because you know they're still going to be going after. You know they would love to sign CM Punk to get him into AEW. And I think for the right amount of money, Punk is no different than anybody else. Yeah, he'd come back. I don't think he'd work for Vince McMahon. But to work with his buddies over there, I think for the right amount of money, you can lure him back. And let's say they do. They sign him to a deal. They're going to bring him into AEW. And then, after they debut him, people realize, well, he wasn't the masked man after all. Then the masked guy finally reveals himself to be Dean Ambrose, who beats the fuck out of CM Punk. Maybe they have like a little signing ceremony in the ring. However they want to do it. At the press conference, maybe. But he beats the piss out of Punk, and we've got a Punk Ambrose program in AEW. It's just a thought. People can think, hey, you know, Dean Ambrose, we haven't seen him in a while. Maybe he's just taking time off from wrestling to enjoy life. He leaves WWE, we don't hear from him for 6 months or a year. He's loving life. He's living his life. Pondering his next move. Or maybe some people think, he's going to end up back in WWE. I'm shocked he didn't go to AEW. I'm shocked he didn't go to Ring of Honor. Maybe he's just going to end up back in WWE soon. And this entire time, this fucker was wrestling under a mask because that just sounds like the sort of thing Dean Ambrose just might want to do. He's a weird guy. But what a swerve and a kickoff to that feud, huh? Just a stupid thought. WWE, speaking of Dean Ambrose, WWE is promoting a live special tonight on the network called The Shield's Last Chapter, promoting it as their final match together. For real this time. Fingers crossed. For real this time, guys. We promise you. It's his final match. They are milking this thing for all that it's worth. And you know what? They may as well do so while they still can, because if he is leaving, they're not going to have him for much longer. And I personally like when they do these live specials on the network. You know, they're going to be cutting in to a live event and airing part of it. I like that. They don't do that very often. I like it when they do things like that. It is scheduled to be Dean's final match in WWE for now. He'll be teaming with Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns, who is now a member of the SmackDown roster. According to the Arena website, I mean, now it's being reported everywhere, but there was earlier in the week, you had all these sites that we think it could be Corbin and his crew. Nobody knows who they're going to be wrestling. I just went on the Arena website and it was listed right there before everybody started picking up on it. And in fact, they are going to be wrestling Men on a Mission to Put Me to Sleep. That being the team of Baron Corbin, Drew McIntyre, and the almighty Bobby Lashley. And I hate lumping McIntyre. When I say Men on a Mission to Put Me to Sleep, I hate lumping McIntyre in there. Because I thought by now this guy would have something going. But even with him, there's just no excitement there. This entire trio is tiresome. And I cannot believe that they kept all three of these guys together on Raw. I thought for sure one of them was going to SmackDown. And they didn't move any of them. Now, they're also promoting Finn Balor. He'll be defending the Intercontinental Championship on this show. That's according to the Arena website, against Elias. It does say card is subject to change. This is a Raw brand event. Balor, much like Roman Reigns, is now a SmackDown star. So I don't know if that might change. Maybe it'll be Samoa Joe defending his U.S. title. I don't know. But Balor is being advertised. And the broadcast portion of this begins at 9:30 p.m. tonight. They're going to be cutting into a live event from the Tax Slayer Center in Moline, Illinois. There's your shitty arena name alert for this week. The Tax Slayer Center. The King Slayer, or is it the Beast Slayer now, I think, right, is what Seth Rollins is calling himself? The Beast Slayer in the Tax Slayer Center. Jesus. According to the WWE Network schedule, the show after this one airs at 11 p.m., so that's 90 minutes for two matches. Plus, I'm sure when that match is over, all three guys, they're going to get on the mic, and they're going to say their goodbyes, and they'll probably air all of that stuff. Rollins tweeted out, he said, "I'm pretty stoked about this weekend taking the black one more time with my boys and in my own backyard. We've had a lot of lasts lately, I know, but I promise this really is the end for a while." There are still people who refuse to believe that the Ambrose stuff is anything but a work. And I still say that you're wrong, but look, if he attacks both of them and then feuds with Rollins for the Universal title, then I'll be man enough to admit that I was wrong. I happen to think I'm not wrong. I think even if Dean Ambrose shows up in another promotion, it'll be like the Bret Hart stuff after Montreal, where all the tinfoil hat brigade will just say, "Well, he's just there as a mole for Vince McMahon. He's gotta sell it, brother." You know, it's like there's just some people that you're never going to be able to convince. But I happen to believe this really is going to be it for him. He's coming up at the end. I mean, look, we're almost at the end of April already, and supposedly his contract was going to the end of April, very beginning of May. And after that, he's free to do whatever he wants. When your contract expires, you're not subject to any kind of 90-day non-compete or anything like that. When your contract is over, it is over. That's it. And I think we're coming up to the end of the Ambrose run here. The superstar shakeup has come and gone. The Raw and SmackDown rosters have been remade. Who ended up the strongest coming out of all this? Well, we'll see in a little bit. First, let me run through all of the Raw roster changes, and then I'll get into my Raw thoughts for the week, and then I'll do the same for SmackDown, and then we'll see who got the better of things. So, these are the newest members of the Monday Night Raw roster. AJ Styles is now a part of Raw. This almost had to happen. He's called SmackDown his home for the past 3 years, almost 3 years. He'd wrestled all of the big names, and this is one of the moves that I pushed for on the podcast last week. I thought that this had to happen, and I was happy to see that he changed brands, and maybe now we'll get some fresh matches with him, and maybe he can help Raw. Hopefully this is a case where Raw doesn't bring AJ down, but AJ can help lift Raw up a little bit. That's the optimist in me trying to be positive about all this. Samoa Joe, back on Raw. He brings with him the United States Championship. The only reason we didn't see Joe on Raw last Monday was because he was near death fighting the flu. So we should see him back tomorrow night. Apparently there was a segment planned with him and Braun Strowman, and instead they had Strowman kill EC3, who has also been drafted to the Raw brand. or drafted to his doom, depending on how you look at it. But they did a dry run the week before, right? They had that dark match at the SmackDown tapings. They did a dry run with Drake Maverick as the new manager for EC3. And I hope for his sake that that becomes a thing. Because without it, this guy is toast. Even with it, the man may be toast. But without it, he does not stand a chance. This could be a fresh start for EC3, but Monday Night Raw was not a very encouraging sign. We have The Miz back on Monday Night Raw now. I guess it does make sense, right? The guy's got a reality show airing on the same network. SmackDown's going to be moving to Fox soon. I must say, he has been more successful as a babyface than I thought he would be. I was not sold on this idea that The Miz was going to have this long run as a babyface because they've tried it before, and it never really worked. People never really fully embraced it, so he went back to being a heel again. He just is a naturally hateable character on this show. I'm not saying he's like that in real life, but he's just a naturally hateable character, hateable face, the whole thing. And I wasn't sold on it. But he's been a babyface for a while now. There's no indication that they're going to be turning him or changing him anytime soon. And he's had a very good run. He's had a very successful run so far at it. The fans are behind him. He gets a reaction when he comes out. It's not like he comes out to crickets, so good for him. Will that continue on Raw? You know, because that was on SmackDown. Will that now continue on Monday Night Raw? We'll see. We'll find out. But I have to give credit where it's due. People have taken to this guy. They've stuck with him, and he's having, you know, a pretty good babyface run for himself so far. Sami Zayn is on Raw, finally, split away from Kevin Owens, which is what I had been pushing for so long. And it's not that I don't find the two of them entertaining together, but we've just seen so many combinations of the two of them as partners and the two of them as enemies. They even had a dark match after SmackDown the week before. They couldn't wait to put these two guys back together. It looks like that may have been their little blow-off for a while, because now they are on separate brands, and I am happy. And I am enjoying what Sami Zayn is doing, his heel work so far. I was very entertained by his segment with Alexa on Monday night. I think Sami's going to be just fine on his own. He and Kevin Owens do not have to be attached at the hip for everything. I think a little separation is going to do them good. Ricochet and Aleister Black, still together. They're keeping these two together. I think it was time to split them. Maybe get them on separate brands even. You know, you debuted them, what was it, a month or two before WrestleMania, which is a very odd time to promote anybody from NXT, let alone your four biggest names. Ciampa got hurt, they pulled back Gargano, and so we were left with Aleister Black and Ricochet, and the fans have taken to them. You know, the fans, I think, have embraced these two, and they're very good. You know, they were two of the biggest names on the NXT brand. But to call them up when they did was a very bizarre thing. And they ended up wrestling on the TakeOver special. They wrestled on WrestleMania. They were on Raw. So these guys, I'm sure, are living on cloud nine right now. But they're single stars. They were put together in this odd combination of, it's almost like opposites attract here. There isn't a whole lot these two have in common if you look at them. And they just put the two of them together, and I figured, all right, well, maybe they just want to establish that NXT, these guys are from NXT, they're really good, you should pay more attention to NXT, NXT could potentially be moving to maybe an FS1 or something in the fall, we don't know, and let WrestleMania come and go, and then you can split them up, and they can begin their singles runs on the main roster. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen for a while. So that was surprising to me. But I look at the tag team division on this show now and how much stronger it is. I think it is stronger than SmackDown. And we'll get into the different divisions later and everything and who benefited. But I do think that they're a big part of that. They're going to be a very big part of that Raw tag team division going forward. And that's a good thing for the Raw brand. But again, I don't think these two should be kept together long term as a team. They're not a tag team. They're singles guys. Especially Aleister Black. I mean, Ricochet too, but Aleister Black, there's money in him as a single. And that is where they should be heading. Rey Mysterio is now part of the Raw brand, as is Andrade Cien Almas, along with Zelina Vega. Thank God they kept the two of them together. So they kept Rey and Andrade on the same brand. It just so happens to be a different color, but they are on the same brand again. I'd love to see them rekindle their little rivalry, but there's been some reports, and I don't know where they come from or how valid they are, but there's been some reports of a possible faction under consideration that would include Rey Mysterio, Andrade, and Sin Cara. Now, I might give more credence to the report if Sin Cara was on the same brand with them, but he's not now. WWE.com still has him listed as a SmackDown guy, so I don't put a lot of stock into this report wherever it comes from. But the thought of it is kind of interesting. You know, if Rey and Andrade somehow end up coming together, you know, maybe they have a few more matches. Rey wins one, Andrade wins one, very evenly matched. And Zelina goes to them and says, look, you two, you guys complement each other very well. I smell money if the two of you come together as a team. And if they're interested in making the Raw Tag Team Division a hot division again, after being dead for so long, and I am not the biggest fan of makeshift teams. I mean, I just got done arguing why I think Black and Ricochet ought to go off on their own. But, if they're not going to, imagine Rey and Almas feuding with the Usos. Or Rey and Almas feuding with Aleister Black and Ricochet. The matches that those four could have together. And the history there. You know, Aleister and Andrade have history from NXT. Rey and Ricochet have history, not that they would mention this, but Rey and Ricochet have a little bit of a history from Lucha Underground. Back in the days when he was running around, Ricochet was, as Prince Puma. Maybe they could even break off coming out of that program and have Rey work singles against Ricochet and have Aleister work with Almas. Or Almas work with Ricochet and Rey works with Aleister. I think that could be a lot of fun. So it is an interesting idea. I don't know how steeped in reality it is, but the idea that Rey and Andrade at some point, after a few more matches together, could come together is interesting to me. The Usos are now on Monday Night Raw, much like AJ Styles. They had done all they could do on the blue brand. There was nothing else for them to do. You can only have so many matches against the New Day. I lost count at how many matches they had. On Raw, they have new people to work with. They have new titles to chase. So it's a win-win. Plus, they also moved Naomi to Raw, so Jimmy and his wife stay on the same brand. You know, after having watched that Vice special on Macho Man and Elizabeth, the match made in heaven, and how overprotective Randy was of her in the locker room. I mean, he would literally lock her in the dressing room sometimes. And this was not breaking news in the documentary. We heard these stories for years. This was already known. But you think about that, and imagine Savage and Liz on the roster today with the brand split. How would he react if they sent Randy Savage to SmackDown and Elizabeth to Raw just to fuck with him? I think he would murder everybody. Oh, no, don't worry, Randy. We're gonna put Liz with Miz. She'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Because you know they would do something like that. I sometimes think about these old school guys, Savage, Flair, Dusty Rhodes, and if they were entering WWE today, or if they were being promoted to the main roster today, it's amazing for me to think about how less of a star each of them would probably be today than they were 30 years ago. I honestly believe that. As talented as Savage was and Dusty, and I do think they would be successful, because sometimes you're just that good, you can't ignore it. And just on promos alone, those two would be incredible. I mean, they would be light years ahead of everybody else right now on the main roster. But in terms of how they're treated or booked, or the matches they would have, the opportunities they would be given, the way TV is done today, the formula they have, as opposed to when those two were making a name for themselves. Do you honestly believe that any of those guys, or a lot of those guys, would end up being as big of a name as they were? I mean, I'm sure some would break through and end up being in that same realm. It's kind of scary when you really think about it, to think that even some of them would just probably land in mid-card obscurity, or they would just be another face in the crowd, and they wouldn't really stand out as being special like they were, you know, all those years ago. Imagine how much talent they would miss out on if these guys were first coming up today. But yeah, most of the married couples were kept together this year, and the best part of all, Bobby Lashley stays on Raw. He can watch over Renee. He did say, he did tell Ambrose he was going to look after her when her husband leaves. So that's good. Lacey Evans is officially on Raw. Nikki Cross is apparently scheduled to be at Raw this week and not at SmackDown. So she may be on Raw as well. That has not been confirmed. And Eric Young. Eric Young is officially a part of the Monday Night Raw roster, which means no more sanity. I mean, I could just watch some of the decisions these people make every week and tell you the same thing, that there's no more sanity. But you know what I mean. Killian Dane posted a tweet wishing the best to Eric Young. He wished the best to Alexander Wolf, who just debuted at the NXT UK tapings. Wolf posted a message on his own Twitter listing all of Sanity's NXT accomplishments and all of their milestones together as a group. Nothing for SmackDown Live. No mention of SmackDown Live, because that would be impossible. To list all of Sanity's accomplishments on SmackDown Live, they don't exist. Setting the record for the most time spent in catering is hardly a milestone that you should be proud to include. And he ended with, it's time to leave this behind and walk a different path. And judging by the NXT UK spoilers, which I won't get into, it is a much better path than the one he was on before. This is an upgrade for this guy. He should be happy that they shifted him over to that UK brand and have him doing what it looks like they have him doing. So for him, it's an upgrade in this shakeup. For the rest of Sanity, not so much. And I was never a big Sanity fan, even when they were in NXT, but they at least deserved a chance to do something on SmackDown, and they never got it. And I would love to hear somebody like Road Dogg, who I'm going to mention later, I would love to hear someone like him, who was a head writer on that show, defend that. I would love to hear him defend that. You know, it's one thing to defend a name change like he was doing this week. Oh, it's not a big deal. You'll get used to it, you marks. But defend that. Explain that one to me, Road Doggy Dog. How do you call up an entire faction of people and do them dirty like that? It's like picking a shiny new car to drive out of the showroom, and then as soon as you go to turn out of the lot, the engine falls out. Why? Why invest so much time into three people or four people just to turn around and act like they don't even exist? And if the answer is, well, there's a lot of people on the roster now. There's only so many spots on TV. There just wasn't a place for them on the show. Then why call them up in the first place? Answer me that. Eric Young's on Raw now. Well, good for him. Eric Young on his own is a dead man walking. Cedric Alexander, he shifts over from 205 Live to Monday Night Raw. Cedric is a talented guy. He had a great story coming out of the Cruiserweight Classic. The fans just literally, basically willed him into a contract. Chanted for Triple H to sign the guy, and he did. And he got a run as the Cruiserweight champion. But Cedric's ceiling is higher than just the Cruiserweight title. Same for Ali. Same for Buddy Murphy. Frankly, the same for Neville before he quit. He could have been a lot more than he was. Some guys are cruiserweights for life, but others should use it as a stepping stone to bigger and better things. And Cedric is a guy who I see as a solid U.S. title level contender. I think that's a good place for him to be. And finally, now on Monday Night Raw, are the NXT Tag Team Champions, the War Raiders, who have since been renamed as the Viking Experience. Let's talk about that, shall we? Let's talk about Monday Night Raw from Montreal, Quebec this past week. First of all, the Raw ratings were down 9% from the Raw after WrestleMania and 26% from the same shakeup episode they did last year. That show did 3.6 million viewers. This one, 2.6 million. Where did those million people go? Where did they go? Did they just vanish into thin air? Were they sleeping? Let that sink in. 26%. Boy, that sure is a lot of cord cutting in a year. A year from now, the numbers are going to be even lower, and the apologists will continue to make excuses. Rinse, repeat. We see this every year. As the numbers continue to trickle down. We had almost 3,800 votes in our raw poll this week. A just paltry 23% thumbs up, 77% thumbs down. That's a lot of very angry Vikings. The War Raiders are now the Viking Experience. Eric and Ivar.
Oh my God!
Which I'm not sure if that's better or worse, but at first I thought they said Igor, but it's not Igor, it's Ivar. And I know that, I looked these names up, there's like some Norse history meaning behind each of these names that they had them pick. It's not just random names they pulled out of the sky. But that's what they are now. Eric and Ivar. They changed their individual names too. So no more Hansen and Roe. They stole Rowan's first name and they gave it to Roe. Roe, Rowan. I smell a conspiracy here. But you know, there was a Sports Business Journal article this week on WWE Developmental in the Performance Center. Big, long article. And it was revealed in the article that Punishment Martinez from Ring of Honor, who signed with WWE last year, is now Damian Priest. That's his new name. And as names go, Damian Priest is not a bad one. The Viking Experience is a bad name. It sounds like they drive their own tour bus line. And I don't care if they came up with the name themselves, which I'm not saying they did, but if it were to come out that, hey, it wasn't Vince McMahon who picked the name, but they picked the name themselves, and they do, especially Eric, I think. He is very big into Viking history, him and his wife, Sarah Logan. They put a video up on the WWE PC channel that showed them doing some kind of Viking reenactment. They do this on the weekends or on their days off. So yes, they are very, very big into Vikings and Viking history. It matters not to me if it were to come out that they themselves came up with the new name. The point is, why force them to change the name in the first place? Why establish your name and your identity on one brand only to change it on the other? It would be like allowing Samoa Joe to be Samoa Joe in NXT and then calling him up and changing his name to Joe Maga. You just wouldn't do it. It doesn't make sense. Well, according to The Observer, it had nothing to do with the word war. Some people thought, well, Vince McMahon doesn't like, you can't use the word war on television, even though they were calling Ember Moon the war goddess on TV, so that made no sense. So that excuse went out the window. I mean, hell, maybe they're treating NXT now like WCW. These guys made the jump, but WWE doesn't have the rights to the name. Maybe Vince McMahon was worried that Triple H might slap a lawsuit on him. He should slap a straitjacket on him, is what he should do. According to The Observer, this was strictly a Vince McMahon call. He wanted them to have a new name, and that's it. That's the explanation. So the day of, they get to the building. These guys are all scrambling to come up with a name now for these guys. And the first name pitched was the Berserkers. Now, we already had one Berserker in WWE, and he tried to kill The Undertaker. Now we would have had two Berserkers. I don't hate that name. I actually don't hate that name. I miss the days when we had kind of cool names like the Berserkers or the Road Warriors or Demolition. I welcome, gimmicky as though they may be, the days of cool-sounding tag team names where you don't have to just use your real name. Some guys use their real names, that's fine. Other guys can have gimmick-type names. I'm cool with that. That's kind of what War Raiders was, and War Raiders wasn't a great name either. War Machine sounds cool. I know why they changed that. Or I think why they changed that with the MMA guy of the same name who's a piece of crap. Like, I know that whole story. But, so the Berserkers, the more I kind of thought about it, and I said that out loud, I said, you know what? Hopefully they don't have these guys coming out holding their fists going, huss, 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 like John Nord used to do. But the Berserkers, you know what? You could do a lot worse as far as names go. I think I could have lived with that. That could have worked. No less stupid, though, to force them to change it. Vince didn't like the Berserker name, and whoever came up with the idea, whether it was Vince or someone else, the Viking Experience was born. And then he had them change their individual names. It was change for the sake of change. They're mine now. I own them. I want to make them my own. Road Dogg was all over Twitter because they were getting so much shit this company was. All over social media, all over Twitter. And Road Dogg was very active on Twitter defending this garbage. Now he's giving his opinion, and there's nothing wrong with giving your opinion. So if his opinion is that the name isn't bad, you guys are overblowing it, like, having an opinion is fine, although this guy has a defense for everything. But his main argument was that in a month, people are going to know the Viking experience more than they did War Machine. Well, I sure as fuck hope so. War Machine was their name in Ring of Honor. Raw has more viewers than ROH does. So of course more people are going to know their name. What does that even mean? He was like answering a different question. The question wasn't about the how long it's going to take for the fans to take to the name. It was that the name is shit. That was the argument. And so I see Road Dogg's tweet. Somebody showed me or whatever, tweeted me about it. And I just quote tweeted. I said, what does that even mean? That's all I said. That's what I asked. What does that have to do with the actual changing of the name? To which Road Dogg replied, if you don't know, just move along. The All-American Rejects over here, this guy now thinks he is. Just move along, he says. Which was a nice little bob and weave on my question, by the way. Names don't matter. That was the other thing I saw Road Dogg tweet at somebody on Monday night. Names don't matter. Names don't matter. His own tag team partner was once called Rockabilly. Rockabilly! I didn't see Rockabilly get inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. The Hall of Shame, maybe. I can't imagine how that name and that gimmick never got over. It's shocking to me. Steve Austin, one of the biggest names of all time in the wrestling business. Before he became Stone Cold, he was the Ringmaster, right? We all know that. But that wasn't even the worst of the names that he was given. One of the names suggested to him, I shit you not, was Fang McFrost. Fang McFrost was one of three horrible names they put on a list for him to choose from because he didn't want to be the Ringmaster anymore. The other two were Ice Dagger and Otto von Ruthless. He would have been Otto von Buried had he picked that name. But seriously, Fang McFrost. He would have sounded like Ronald McDonald's arch nemesis with that name. I somehow doubt that Fang 316 would have caught on quite as well. Need I remind you all about NXT Season 2 on Sci-Fi and the legend of Eli Cottonwood? And you're going to tell me that names don't matter? What if they had called you Road Dirt? You think that would have worked as well? So PW Insider said that Road Dirt, or Road Dogg, was not in Montreal for any of the tapings this week, which means he was home tweeting. The belief is that he is taking a, quote, extended break for a while as they reassess things. They reassess his role and try to figure out where he may best fit in going forward, now that he's no longer one of the head writers on SmackDown Live. An extended break means more time for him to tweet. And judging by some of the ones from Monday, I'm not so sure that's such a good thing. Yes, a bad name can be overcome. A bad name can be overcome, and maybe we are all overreacting. If you have the talent, I'd like to think that even a shitty name can be overcome. I'd rather deal with a bad name than bad booking. But it's the idea that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's the point of all this. That's the point that Road Dogg didn't seem to comprehend that people had an issue with here. Vince McMahon does not adhere to that rule, clearly. He'll steal Hank the Bear, your favorite stuffed animal, rip the fucking stuffing out of it, then ask somebody to tape his insides back together and call him Bumblefuck the Bear from now on. Or the Bear Experience, which sounds like some gay porno movie. But that's what he would do. You've got enough problems to address without creating new ones. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. They at least won. They won their first match. They teamed with the Revival and they beat Aleister Black, Ricochet, Zack Ryder, and Curt Hawkins. They pinned Zack Ryder, Hawkins and Ryder, your Raw Tag Team Champions. This was a champs are chumps kind of night. Ryder and Hawkins, Finn Balor, and the Iconics, all champions, all defeated. By the way, they've now added a bullet ricochet noise, like you hear in a cartoon or in a gunfight in an old Western. They've added a ricochet noise to the start of Ricochet's entrance. This is after they added the creaking coffin noise to Aleister Black's entrance. This is a show for kids. I know. It's a show for kids. Even though the age of the average Raw viewer now is something like 50 years old, but it's a show for kids. We had Balor and Andrade, one of the few highlights of this show. We had Zelina Vega hit her. We've seen her do this spot in NXT. It's great. Referee's distracted. Zelina, is this tiny little woman, gets up on the apron, jumps off, hits a Rana on Andrade's opponent. And they got Balor back inside. Hammerlock DDT for a win in his Raw debut over the Intercontinental Champion. My first thought when I saw that is that Balor's going to SmackDown. That was the first thing I thought when I saw him get pinned on Monday. My first thought wasn't, oh, these guys are going to have an extended program. It was, he's doing the honors on the way out. May as well put the guy over. And that's what they did. Rey Mysterio came out to interrupt Elias. Elias went after him. Rey botched a top rope Hurricane Rana. Very rare that we see Rey fuck up a move like that, but the people like Rey, and so they ignored it. This brought out Lars Sullivan. Freak accident. And then he hit his new move, a running sit-out powerbomb, which looks a lot more devastating than the freak accident does. Bobby Roode and Chad Gable were in the ring for some rare mic time. So they're on the microphone, and Bobby Roode says, and Gable got some talking time as well, and they say that we can beat any team in WWE. Out come the Usos, which might have been a surprise had they not put a graphic on the screen when Roode and Gable first came out with the Usos name on it. Oops. Usos won with stereo splashes on Gable for the win. And just like that, Roode and Gable are no more. Chad Gable has gone to SmackDown. And after he paid to have matching robes made and all, I'm sure those robes are not inexpensive. We had a moment of bliss in Montreal with the hometown hero Sami Zayn. All the fans sang to his theme song, or hummed to his theme song. He even got them to do the old ole, ole, ole chant. He said it was great to be back in the city he loves. It's just the people that I can't stand. It's kind of like the internet, right? The internet's great. Twitter, all these different platforms. It's great. Except for the people. Were it not for the people, these platforms would be fantastic. But the internet is a cesspool. Because of the people. He reminded the fans that he doesn't live there anymore. He now lives in sunny Orlando, Florida. Crowd sang the Na 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 goodbye song to him. He said, see you in hell. And he dropped the mic and he walked out. This was great. This was great. Sammy's clearly enjoying himself out there. You can tell. Bayley has not been enjoying herself so much. She did the segment. She was not able to get her tag team partner Sasha Banks on the phone. She should probably try sending her a message on Instagram. She'll be all over that. So instead, she teamed with Naomi, newest addition to the Raw roster, and they beat the Iconics. The women's tag team champions were pinned. Sasha thought they were going to make them mean something. That's cute. I already mentioned Braun killing EC3, pissing on his grave like his last name was Russo, so we won't recap that. Becky Lynch got a win over Ruby Riott with the Disarmer. The last that we will see of the full Riott squad together, since they split them up the very next night. Natalya came out when this match was over. She came out to congratulate Becky on her win and headlining WrestleMania. She then called herself, Natty did, the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. And said that she was coming for Becky's Raw Women's Championship. And you know, I'm old enough to remember when saying that actually meant something. The reason it got such a tepid reaction in Montreal is because nobody buys it as being even remotely true. Lacey Evans interrupted to perform her community theater act. The McMahons decreed that she would face Natalya, and the winner of that match would earn the right to challenge Becky Lynch. So of course, Lacey won with a moonsault that looked like she could have broken Natty's arm on the way down. I cringed with that landing. It reminded me of Kurt Angle's moonsault on SmackDown. When he moonsaulted, landed on Bob Holly's arm, broke Holly's arm, because his leg just landed right on top of the arm. Thankfully, Natty was okay. So we're getting the lady against the man. That's the feud that we're going to get now. The lady against the man. And here I thought Triple H said they didn't like intergender wrestling. AJ Styles, at the end of the show, was revealed to be the mystery tag team partner for Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins in the main event against who else? Who else? Baron Corbin, Bobby Lashley, and Drew McIntyre. I almost fell asleep just saying that. AJ beat Lashley with the phenomenal forearm. So they tried to, up and down this show, give wins to the newest roster members. They did with Andrade against Balor. They did here with AJ being the one to pin Lashley. So, yeah, that's cool and all. But overall, as far as a shakeup episode is concerned, I thought a pretty average edition of Raw. I did enjoy the Almas-Balor match, but the whole Viking experience thing clearly pissed a lot of people off, and rightfully so, because you have an act that's established to one audience that you have on the NXT brand, a brand that was a very big part of WrestleMania weekend, tore the house down against Aleister Black and Ricochet, two guys who got to keep their names, and the only reason these two didn't is because the old man said, I'm not really feeling it, let's just pick something new. And that's just not a good enough excuse. It's his show. It's his baby. He could do what he wants. But that's not a good enough excuse. You can't be fucking around with acts like this and not expect there to be some backlash from it and not expect to piss people off who actually care about some of these guys and do follow them through NXT. I know not everybody does. But you can't just shit on one segment of your audience to please another. You should be trying to please all of your fans. And it's not always such a difficult thing to do. You can't please everybody at all times, but you surely can stay away from doing trivial, stupid shit like this that's completely unnecessary and shooting yourself in the foot. Let's switch over to SmackDown. The newest members of the SmackDown Live roster are as follows. The Big Dog, Roman Reigns. Woof woof. He is now on the SmackDown roster. This was not a huge surprise, another move that I had floated last week when I was given my rundown of the moves that I thought might be made. Because Roman, I think, on SmackDown is kind of, in their eyes, a big deal for SmackDown, certainly heading into the Fox period here, the Fox era this fall. You know they're going to want some big names on that show, and before long we might hear that Brock Lesnar is on SmackDown, or Ronda Rousey if she comes back later this year. Maybe she's on SmackDown. So Roman, to me, just felt like a gimme. Finn Balor and the Intercontinental Championship are now on SmackDown. They do this every now and then. They'll switch the titles. So the US title goes to Raw. The IC title goes to SmackDown. Elias is on SmackDown. Lars Sullivan has found a home, apparently, it looks like, on SmackDown. We also have Heavy Machinery, Kairi Sane from NXT, Bayley, Ember Moon, Mickie James, Liv Morgan, which ends the Riot Squad, Chad Gable, so Glorious Gable is no more, Apollo Crews, and from 205 Live, Buddy Murphy. They are all now officially members of the SmackDown roster. SmackDown was back in Montreal on Tuesday night. 3,000 votes, 58% thumbs up, 42% thumbs down, which as SmackDown goes is not good numbers. Normally those numbers are a little higher on the positives. This was a lot closer than SmackDown is on most weeks. As well it should have been, because this was, on the whole, I thought, a pretty boring show. Wouldn't call it a terrible show, but it was boring. We had Kevin Owens. Now, he was over huge in Montreal. He was speaking in French. He introduced Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods of the New Day as his guests on the Kevin Owens show. No Big E, because Big E is out. He had surgery on a torn meniscus. He's going to be out for at least a few more weeks. And so they had this whole segment, and they were all, you know, acting goofy and stuff, and Kevin Owens offered to take Big E's spot in a six-man tag team match set for later on in the show. And then he ends up putting on some of the New Day gear. There was a shirt. There was a unicorn horn. He's dancing with them. And, you know, look, it's mindless fun. There's nothing wrong with it. It's mindless fun. But God, I hope these next few weeks leads to Kevin Owens just obliterating the New Day and turning heel again. We had Finn Balor against Mustafa Ali. Balor had the two best matches on either show this week, Monday night against Andrade Cien Almas, here on SmackDown against Mustafa Ali, two victims of recent name changes. Now, neither one of these matches was still as good as the match we got with Buddy Murphy and Velveteen Dream on NXT. That was the match of the week, but Balor's matches really on Raw and SmackDown this week were the standout, and he did pin Ali. It was a good match, good showing for Ali, but in the end, the champion actually won this time, which he had to because he lost on Monday. We had Becky Lynch out for another promo. She was interrupted this time by Ember Moon. Bayley then made her SmackDown debut and was met with boos. They booed Bayley in Montreal. Then the Iconics came out, then Paige came out. I hated this segment, by the way. Hated it. So far up to this point in the segment, we had Ember Moon interrupt Becky, Bayley interrupt Ember, the Iconics interrupted Bayley and Ember, then Paige was out to announce her new team when she was interrupted by Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville, who thought that we were getting ready to see an Absolution reunion. Paige told them not so fast, and then she introduced her real team, Asuka and Kairi Sane. And then a giant brawl broke out. This was all done to set up a match with Asuka, Kairi, Bayley, and Ember against Mandy, Sonya, and the Iconics. And Kairi Sane hit the giant elbow off the top rope on Peyton Royce for the win. Back-to-back nights. Women's tag team champs are losers. Even Balor at least won his match on Tuesday. Not the Iconics. I'm going to keep an open mind about the pairing of Asuka and Kairi Sane. I was surprised they didn't keep Kairi together with Io Shirai, but maybe Io takes the NXT title from Shayna Baszler. If they really don't have any plans for Asuka, which clearly they don't, let's just be honest, they have no plans for Asuka, at least not as a single, and Becky's got both belts right now, then having these two challenge for the tag team titles may not be a terrible idea. The quicker they get those belts off the Iconics, the better. I do not consider myself an Iconics fan. I was not advocating for them to put the belts on them. And it's only been a few weeks now since WrestleMania, and already they're treated like a joke. They are not treated any better or any more seriously than they were before WrestleMania. You have these new titles that you want them to at least feel somewhat special. You're trying to establish them, and they're already a joke. They're a laughingstock. The quicker they get those belts off these two, the better. Maybe they'll get them on Asuka and Kairi in the next few weeks. So it may not be a terrible idea to try these two out as a tag team. Here's my bigger problem with this. Asuka beat Becky Lynch at the Royal Rumble. Tapped her out, even. Now, it doesn't need to be right away, because I'm sure Asuka would lose if they did that feud now. So it might be better to wait, but they better damn well follow up on this at some point, because that is one hell of a loose end to leave hanging out there. Makes no sense for Asuka to not be chasing after Becky on day one after she won those titles at WrestleMania, but at some point, it needs to be followed up on. Now, Paige is their manager, gives them, first of all, gives Paige an on-air role, gives her something to do, and it gives the two of them a mouthpiece. You know, WWE is all about memorizing long promos, and so giving them a manager helps take care of that. I'm going to keep an open mind, but they need to come back to that story angle with Asuka and Becky and follow up on that, because if they don't, that's just creative malpractice. I don't know how you can do that and just ignore it and pretend that it never happened. They're going to have to follow up on that at some point in the not too distant future. Now, the Bayley boos were interesting. It's happened a few times before, but it hasn't happened in a while. You know, it could have been an isolated incident. The night before, they were in Montreal in the same building and she wasn't booed the way that she was, at least on Tuesday. I didn't hear boos. I heard indifference. I heard apathy when Bayley came out. On Tuesday, there were audible boos. And I don't know if it's just the matter of the Sasha stuff kind of rubbing off on her in a negative way, or it may just be a case of people are over Bayley. They're done with her. They've had enough with this gimmick. They've had enough with this character. She never does anything. I mean, yes, they won the women's tag team titles, but now she's back on her own. And it's just played out, and people are done with it. People are fed up with it. I've heard Bayley in radio interviews before talk about how she would love one day to go heel. I don't know, maybe it's time. Maybe it's time for that. Maybe heel emo Bayley is the way to go. I don't know, but clearly there's some kind of refresh that's going to be needed here. Because maybe it turns out not to be an isolated incident. Maybe they're back on American soil this week, and Bayley is getting some boos even here. Or maybe it'll just be an aberration and she'll come out on TV this week and get massive cheers. We'll see. But that was quite the sight to watch her come out. And it wasn't just a few scatter boos. I mean, she came out, you would think she was a heel. She was getting the Roman Reigns treatment when she came out. I would hardly say that Bayley is someone who's being shoved down our throats. So there's got to be some kind of other explanation for it, other than Canada is bizarro world. Maybe in this case they were. I don't know. But it was something. But I think if ever there was a character that needed a refresh right now, it's Bayley. Now, there was no Sasha Banks on TV this week. They're giving her a few weeks to cool down, think things over. She had said that she wanted to quit. She's been on vacation with her husband. They're hopeful that she's going to be back in time for the Money in the Bank pay-per-view on May 19th. Uh-oh, I said that date, May 19th. Apparently others in the company knew in advance that she and Bayley were dropping the women's tag team titles at WrestleMania, except them. Nobody clued them in on about that fact until the day of. That and the fact that she and Bayley were being split up as a team. She apparently was told that they were no longer going to be a team, and all of these things together just really set her off. But I've said this before, this was no isolated incident. Sasha Banks has not been walking around with a smile on her face, and then she found out, oh, you're losing the women's tag team titles at WrestleMania, and all of a sudden she wants to quit. That's not how this works. These things are just the cherry on top of a giant shit sundae that she feels she's been served for a while now, and she just had enough. Kevin Owens, as the honorary member of New Day, teamed up with Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods to beat Cesaro, Rusev, and Shinsuke Nakamura. Trouble in Paradise into the stunner from Owens, and that's all she wrote. When the match was over, Owens, Kofi, Xavier, they danced, they celebrated. No attack from Kevin Owens. I can only hope they're going to do the slow burn. And this is all building to Kevin Owens just snapping and turning on them, because Kevin Owens should be challenging for the WWE Championship. He would make sense as somebody who could be the next challenger, the next opponent for Kofi Kingston. And I hope it happens. So I can tolerate Kevin Owens dancing and being all goofy for a few weeks if it builds to that. And if it doesn't, well, I don't know what else to say about this. I really don't. The biggest acquisition in SmackDown Live history. That's what they were promoting in advance of the show on Tuesday, that Vince McMahon was going to show up to announce the biggest acquisition in the history of the show. We've had Hulk Hogan get drafted to SmackDown, The Rock, all of these. Nobody would be bigger than this person. And Elias was introduced. We all knew it wasn't going to be Elias. It's just a matter of who else is going to come out here. So Vince, you know, is out there with Elias, and then the music hits, and out comes Roman Reigns. Roman Reigns, in the eyes of WWE, is the biggest talent acquisition in SmackDown Live history. Vince was not happy about this. Elias was not happy about the interruption. He got taken down with a spear. Vince got up in Roman's grill, and Roman hit him with a Superman punch, and Vince had the funniest sell to a Superman punch that I've ever seen. He just gently fell backwards, like his body was frozen. He was paralyzed and fell backwards into the arms of Elias, because he's a senior citizen now. Now, he's a senior citizen in great shape, I'll give him that. Probably looks physically better than I do, but he's still 70. What is he now, 72, 74? He's starting to look it. Just funny the way he sort of fell back. But then again, Vince always had problems selling moves in general. I mean, when has Vince McMahon ever sold a move and made it look great? I mean, maybe the punt kick by Randy Orton, there wasn't anything he had to do except fall down. He would take stunners and look like a fool. He always looked awkward. He wasn't a trained wrestler. Shane, now Shane would take some wacky bumps, but not Vince. Some things never change. And he ended up giving Elias a second spear. He stood tall. And so now the preview for SmackDown this Tuesday is, what are the repercussions going to be for Roman Reigns? Is he going to be fired by the chairman? Stay tuned. As if. Will he or won't he be fired? And I read that and I just was like, oh God. Because if it's one segment that leads to them setting up Roman's next program, fine. Randy Orton, I think, is the name that likely makes the most sense. He's without an opponent now after AJ Styles switched over to the Raw brand. Now Randy can't get his revenge for what happened at WrestleMania. Lars Sullivan, and by the way, I think Randy should start coming out to the ring wearing sunglasses. I just think, you know, that would be funny given the whole light thing. But Lars Sullivan was the other name I kind of came up with here. And I really hope it's not him, just because I think it's too early for that. But if they actually want to have Roman put him over, which may have been the original plan for WrestleMania with John Cena, if Cena had wrestled Lars, I mean, look, it's John Cena, right? But I'm pretty sure the idea was for Lars to beat John Cena at WrestleMania and not for it to be another Bray Wyatt type situation. And so if they were going to potentially put Lars over a big name like Cena, who's not full-time the way Roman is now, but maybe that could be the idea here. He wrestles Roman and Roman can't beat this guy. Look, this is a company that at one point in a television match on SmackDown had Vladimir Kozlov cleanly pin The Undertaker in the middle of the ring. The Undertaker was on the top rope. He was walking the ropes and Kozlov basically jerked him off and pinned it. Well, let me rephrase that. He grabbed The Undertaker and slammed him. There we go. He slammed him down. Boy. Slammed him down on the mat and pinned him clean in the middle of the ring. So I put nothing past these people. If they are that big on Lars Sullivan and they have big plans for this guy, then yeah, I could see them putting him in there with Roman Reigns and giving him a big win. But what are you going to do? You're going to give him a big win over Roman Reigns and then that's it? He just moves on to somebody at a lower level and Roman moves on to somebody else. They're going to end up having a program together. The guy just debuted. I think it's too soon. Even Brock Lesnar wasn't getting in the ring with Hulk Hogan and The Rock until he was 5-6 months into his run back in 2002. He didn't debut and 3 weeks later have a match on TV against Hulk Hogan. So I think, as now I don't know how exciting of a feud this would be, but I look at the names on SmackDown, and again, the name that I think would make the most sense is Randy Orton. We'll see. We'll find out on Tuesday what they have up their sleeve here. But the whole, you know, as a one-time segment to set something bigger up is fine, but not another Roman versus Vince McMahon feud or the Authority or whatever. It's like, we already saw this a few years ago, and I don't want to hear, I already got this from a couple of people where it's like, well, you didn't have a problem with Steve Austin feuding with Vince McMahon for months and years on end back in the day. You know, Roman, it's not okay. You're picking on Roman. Vince McMahon wasn't an overexposed senior citizen when he first feuded with Steve Austin. What are you, dense? It's tired shtick. And hopefully this doesn't become a thing. Kofi Kingston will be taking on Shinsuke Nakamura on Tuesday, and they're also promoting a face-off for the first time since WrestleMania between Becky Lynch and Charlotte Flair. You thought we were done with the two of them. Not so fast. So, who got the better end of the shakeup? Let's take a look at this. The biggest men's names on Monday Night Raw right now, not counting Brock Lesnar, who's never around, but technically still a part of the Raw roster. It looks like this. We have Seth Rollins as the Universal Champion. We have AJ Styles, Braun Strowman, Samoa Joe, Drew McIntyre. And we've got Bobby Lashley, Baron Corbin, Rey Mysterio, Sami Zayn, and Andrade Cien Almas. So that's the Raw brand roster, all the key men's players on the show. The biggest men's names on SmackDown Live now include Roman Reigns, Daniel Bryan, Randy Orton, Finn Balor, Kofi Kingston, Kevin Owens, and Lars Sullivan. I got to give the edge to Raw. The slight edge. But I got to give the edge to Raw. Just in terms of the number of guys and star power, I give the edge to Raw. One area where Raw really improved, and actually before I even move on here, one of the reasons I didn't even bring up Daniel Bryan as a possible suggestion, as an opponent, a first opponent for Roman Reigns, is because my impression is that he's hurt. And he could be out for a while. Nobody seems to know what's going on with Daniel Bryan, which is very scary. Whatever happened to him, he was clearly injured at WrestleMania. I don't know what the nature of the injury is or was. I know Kofi was stomping on his head. And I wasn't even blaming Kofi. It was more, why the fuck would Daniel Bryan even agree to incorporate a spot like that into his matches? It's just dumb. It's just stupid. Whoever's responsible for that. And I doubt Kofi came up with that spot all on his own. That's a Daniel Bryan spot. And obviously they had his opponent turn it around on him this time. But of all the people to be on the receiving end of repeated stomps to the skull, I don't think it was too bright for Daniel Bryan to be that person. And God forbid, if he suffered a concussion, and they're keeping things under wraps right now, and if, again, I don't want this to be the outcome to this, but if that were to be it, if he suffered a concussion and they will not clear him and we're right back to square one again with this guy having to retire, then he's got nobody to blame but himself. So I hope that's not the case, and I hope whatever it is something he can get over quickly and come back, but I don't get the sense that that may be happening so quickly. So as far as him feuding with Roman, I don't think that's the direction they're going in, although at some point I think it would be cool to see the two of them have some kind of a program together. But that's why I mentioned Randy Orton's name and Lars as a possibility, which I'm not hot on, as being the most realistic options to put with Roman in his first program on SmackDown, and I didn't mention Bryan's name. But SmackDown, as far as tag teams, well, let's get into tag teams here. So I give the edge to Raw as far as the core singles stars on the men's side. One area where Raw really improved in the shakeup was tag teams. They had a dead tag team division that, like PCO, has been brought back to life with the Usos, who arguably are certainly one of the, if not the best tag team in the world right now. The Revival, Aleister Black and Ricochet, Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins, and the War Raiders, plus AOP, whenever they're ready to come back, The Ascension, Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel. That's eight teams, even if only half of them have any actual legitimacy right now. That's eight teams on the tag team roster. SmackDown suffered a big blow on the tag team front, losing the Usos. They still have the New Day, although not for a while since Big E is out with his knee injury. They have the New Day, they have the Hardy Boys, who currently hold the SmackDown tag team titles. They have The Bar, and Sheamus is another one. He's out with an injury. Rusev and Nakamura, Gallows and Anderson, who I am convinced are on their way out later this year. And Heavy Machinery have been shaken up, and they're now on the SmackDown roster as well. When you look at these divisions, SmackDown really did suffer a big blow on the tag team side. And again, I say advantage Monday Night Raw when I compare the two. Then we have the women. Over on Raw, Becky Lynch, Sasha Banks, if she decides to come back to work, Natalia, Lacey Evans, Alexa Bliss, Naomi, Ruby Riott, Sarah Logan, Alicia Fox, Dana Brooke, Nia Jax, Tamina, Zelina Vega, and it looks like, maybe, Nikki Cross. Now you look at SmackDown. Now, where Raw benefited from a tag team boost, SmackDown benefited on the female side with this shakeup, which it desperately needed. That division has needed a shakeup for a very long time. So now they have Becky Lynch, Charlotte Flair, Ember Moon, Bayley, Carmella, Mickie James, Liv Morgan, Lana, Asuka and Kairi Sane, Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville, and the Iconics. I have to give the slight edge to SmackDown here. They both have a lot of women, especially Raw. There's a lot of women now on that brand. But as far as who has the edge now with the women's division, I would give the slight edge to SmackDown on that front. So when I look at all of these things, the men's roster, the women's roster, the tag teams, I think Monday Night Raw beat SmackDown in the shakeup this year. I won't say by much. I'm not even saying I'm going to end up enjoying Raw now all of a sudden more than I do SmackDown. But on the strength of the moves they made and the rosters they now have in place, I have to give the edge to Monday Night Raw. On Tuesday, Luke Harper posted that he has requested his release from WWE. He posted a message that read, "As of this evening, I have requested a release from WWE. The past 6 years have been a simply amazing journey around the world and back with lifelong friends and family. I am proud of it all and proud to say I shared the ring with my coworkers. This decision, as difficult as it was, feels right for myself and WWE. My goal in the future is to continue to grow as a performer and a person and continue to make my family proud. Thank you. From the top to the bottom of the WWE, thank you to the fans for your undying support. Thank you, everyone." No word yet on whether WWE will actually grant his request. According to the Observer, the belief is that his contract does not expire until November. So if they say no, it could be a very awkward few months for Luke Harper. Now, he took the high road in that message. Very respectful, very humble, very cordial. And wisely, he went public with it, much the same way Ty Dillinger did. And Ty Dillinger got his release. Now, Luke Harper is probably a bigger, well, not even probably. In the WWE pecking order, he would have been considered a slightly bigger star, slightly bigger name than Ty Dillinger. But let's be honest, not by much. Not where Harper's been slotted now for a while. So, Dillinger got his release. And maybe he would have gotten it anyway. But he went public. Whether WWE knew he was doing that or not, I don't know. But he didn't just go to WWE in private and say, I want my release. He then went, he did that and then went to social media and said, hey guys, guess what I just did? I went to WWE and asked for my release, and I want all of you to know that I did that too. It's smart, and it makes them look bad if it appears they're holding this guy hostage. Yes, he signed his contract. And if they want him to live up to that contract, then he's obligated to live up to the rest of that contract. But perception is everything. Perception is a very important thing to this company. Not when it comes to Saudi Arabia necessarily. They'll take the money and run, but that's a different story. But perception is very important. Luke Harper is very well liked. Like I said, very humble, very respectful in that message, but very public. He didn't have to do that. He could have waited to get an answer from them and then said, hey, I got my release. I'm now free to take bookings. Or if they said no, he could have just continued to keep his mouth shut and we would have been none the wiser. There's a reason he did it this way, and I think it's smart. He's got nothing to lose. If he's 1 foot out the door anyway and ends up pissing a few people off by doing what he did, who cares? What are they going to do, job him out? Can't be any worse than what they've had him doing, which is nothing. It's like he doesn't even exist. You know, when Rowan went down with an injury last year, he decided to go ahead. He had some nagging injuries of his own taken care of. I know he had surgery on his wrist. Now, I know he's had a couple of injuries, big injuries during his run. I saw some people, oh, he's injury prone. It was the injuries. I don't get the sense that this guy was injury prone. I can think of a knee injury that he had and the wrist surgery. So it's not really a case of him being hurt all the time. I don't know where these reports are that people are reading that Luke Harper was always hurt. It was two injuries. Two injuries now equals injury prone. Even if there's a third lesser injury I'm not privy to. The guy does not have any kind of reputation as being injury prone. He was not constantly down injured. I don't know where that's coming from. Let's put that narrative to bed right now. You know, because now Rowan has been out a few times with injuries, with arm injuries. He had a torn bicep, he had a rotator cuff tear. But for Harper, I don't think that's been a big issue. He made his return to the ring last month. He wrestled Donovan Dijak at WrestleMania Access. They had that One World Collide special. He had a Michinoku driver to Dijak from the apron to the floor. And Dijak is a big dude. He's like 6'6". So is Harper. He's a big dude also. But that was nuts. Then he was in the Andre Battle Royal at WrestleMania, but otherwise he hasn't done much. I thought if they wanted to keep him and Rowan together, they could have had him come back at the end of the Elimination Chamber match, get into the chamber somehow to help Brian beat Kofi. He beat Kofi anyway. He could have given Brian the assist. He could have made his return and Rowan was, let's say, unable to get inside or he had already been disposed of outside by the other New Day members. Nobody would have been expecting Luke Harper maybe comes up from underneath the ring or something and gives Brian the assist in the chamber match. And then Brian ends up having his own sustainable little Wyatt family and they can wrestle six-mans on TV, which we all know WWE loves their six-mans. Or there's another option. They could have given this guy a complete overhaul. Now the man can talk. Maybe let him take his character in a totally different direction that allows him to speak more, show more personality. Just something totally different that might help get him more TV time. But they did nothing. Maybe because they were going into WrestleMania and the timing just wasn't right. He obviously wants to have the freedom to explore his options elsewhere. And I hope he gets it. Even with all the options that are out there now, it can't be easy to walk away from a sure thing. He had job security with WWE, probably was making good money. I mean, I don't know what he's making, and it's none of my business, but I'm sure he's able to support his family quite well. And it can't be easy to just say, you know what, I'm going to walk away from this. I'm going to walk away from a sure thing. I'm going to walk away from working for the biggest company in the world. Always know your worth. Don't let other people dictate what they think you're worth. Always know your worth. And in this case, he's recognizing, look, I could be doing better. People still bring up the Randy Orton Bray Wyatt match at WrestleMania 33 for the championship, and it baffles me that Harper was not involved in that match, especially since he was probably the most interesting part of that entire storyline. His distrust and dislike of Randy Orton being part of the Wyatt family, being suspect of his intentions. He had a match against AJ Styles on TV to determine the number one contender for the championship at WrestleMania, and then he lost, and then at WrestleMania, he was relegated to the Andre Battle Royal. That seems to be a recurring role for him. Orton and Bray went on to have an atrocious match for the championship, one of the worst I've ever seen at WrestleMania, ever. Not the worst, necessarily, but one of the worst. A match that certainly could have benefited from Luke Harper. More like Luke Harper and less corny CGI. Remember, this was the WrestleMania where Orton was upset or cracked a joke at a Comic-Con or something because it looked like he was riding on this giant sperm down to the ring. It was supposed to be a snake, but it looked like from above, as he was walking down the ramp, this CGI that was underneath his feet, it looked like he was riding a giant sperm down to the ring. Not even snakes and sperm could save that match. That could be, by the way, that could be the title for a Jake Roberts book if he ever decides to write one. Snakes and sperm, especially after that one story that he loves to tell about the rib he played on Rick Rude, which I wish I had never heard in the first place, nor am I going to repeat it here. I think it was actually Kevin Castle on Twitter. I'll give him a shout out. He said something that I agree with, which is that if Harper does leave, if he does get his release and he leaves the company, it might make more sense for him to land in a place like Ring of Honor first, where he might have a better shot of being higher up on the card, and his name might mean more than it would if he just walked right on into AEW. I know it's cute and all for people to overuse that Cody gif, but when you do that for everyone, you end up with a situation like Vincent and Bryan Adams in the NWO. AEW also needs to be careful not to be branded as the land of the WWE castaways, like TNA was for a while. I could see him going somewhere else. I don't know if he'd even be interested maybe in having a run in Japan or something, but build up his name more as a singles guy. And eventually he could go to AEW, or he could go back to WWE, like Drew McIntyre did, and maybe be higher up in the pecking order than he would have been otherwise. It's his decision to make. But I don't think that would be a bad idea. And I'm not president of the Luke Harper fan club or anything like that, but I respect the guy's work. And he was part of some of those fantastic six-man tags with the Wyatt family against the Shield in 2014. A lot of you mentioned the ladder match, which had slipped my mind, but the TLC pay-per-view that same year, he had a ladder match for the Intercontinental Championship against Dolph Ziggler. That was a war that those two guys had. They beat the hell out of each other with that ladder. I think they might have both been busted open. I remember that there was a scary spot in that match where Harper got his arm caught, got his arm tangled up in the ladder. But he never did much beyond that as a single star. In fact, I think Harper's run as IC champion, which I completely forgot about, lasted, I think, all of a month. That was his big run as a singles champion in the company. Now, maybe he'll get his chance, but only if WWE decides to let him go and give it to him. If not, it's going to be a long 6 or 7 months for him. Savage tweet of the week. Becky Lynch and Lacey Evans have been in a war of words on Twitter, a lot more tame than the one that Becky had with Ronda Rousey, who says that she is on an impregnation vacation right now with her husband, Travis Brown. Is that what they're called now? I'm going to have one of my own in Vegas next month for the AEW show, only without the impregnation part. I hope. I guess I can't guarantee anything, but you know what they say. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Anyway, Lacey told her, "Good thing you're practicing bowing down. My heels will need cleaning when I'm done taking everything you've worked for." Riveting. Cue Becky Lynch, who responded, tall, blonde, does a moonsault, tells me to bow, is from the Carolinas. Might be time to ask Mama Evans if Rick was natching around there before you were born, you plank. Ah, yes. I miss this Becky. It's been a while since I've seen a good savage tweet from her. This was better than either one of the promos that she cut on TV this week, I can say that.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
NXT this week opened with Velveteen Dream defending his North American Championship against Buddy Murphy. I guess Murphy wanted to make one last stop in his old stomping grounds before heading to SmackDown. They had an excellent match. Dream is on a roll with the great matches that he's had, Matt Riddle at TakeOver. I fear for Riddle now when he makes that main roster after what we saw this week with the Viking Experience or Viking Express or whatever the fuck. I fear for this man when he makes the main roster, because you just know that Vince McMahon is going to hear that name and think he's a fucking Batman villain or something. Riddle me this, bro. Riddle me this, bro. But with Dream, the key is that he's getting big wins. These wins give him credibility. They make that title feel like something everybody wants to get their hands on. The complete opposite of how they've treated the women's tag team titles on the main roster is what they've done here with this North American Championship. Now, Mauro Ranallo had this one line where he said, Dream has more flash than Adobe. Can you imagine the vitriol if Michael Cole had uttered a line like that on TV? They'd be calling for his head. Murphy murdered him. He murdered the Dream with a running knee to the head, knocked him off the apron. He couldn't get him back inside in time. But with presence of mind, Murphy rolled into the ring quickly and rolled right back out to break up the count, because he's smart enough to know that you can't win the championship on a countout. When he rolled Dream back inside, though, Dream caught him with a Famasser, Dream Valley Driver, went to the top, hit the Purple Rain elbow for the win. This was a hell of a match. This was the best WWE match all week. And they've got something special in Buddy Murphy on that SmackDown brand. I hope they understand that. The Street Profits were headed into William Regal's office to ask for a tag team title shot, but when they knocked, the Viking Express walked out and they said they already went to Regal themselves to ask for the match next week. And these guys were wearing their new War Raiders t-shirt here in this segment. They had merch. They had merch made. That now, you know, they're going to have to send all their remaining inventory off to some third world country, where they send those New York Mets World Series champion shirts from 2015. Yes, I have not forgotten. And I never will. Johnny Gargano made his first appearance at Full Sail as the new NXT champion. He was interrupted by Adam Cole in Undisputed Era, which, you know, while we're on the subject of stupid names, if we're being fair about this, Undisputed Era is a pretty fucking stupid name for a faction. Let's just be honest. And if you disagree with that, you're fooling yourself. Undisputed, I'd be okay with. Undisputed Era as a faction name, I never quite understood that. Roderick Strong ended up attacking Gargano from behind, and they held him for Cole to deliver a super kick and leave him laying. Later on in the show, they announced that it would be Gargano against Roddy next week. And Adam Cole was, if you watched him, if you paid attention to his facial expressions and his mannerisms, he was kind of teasing that he was upset. He thought it was going to be him and Gargano next week, and it turns out to be a different member of his family. And it just seems, you know, if you saw the YouTube video they put up after the end of TakeOver, it was Adam Cole in the back with the members of the Undisputed Era, and he was kind of taking them to task for not being there. What happened? I lost. What happened? Where were you guys? It seems like they're planting some seeds here for something down the road. I think it would be a mistake to break them up and then call them up. I think that they stand a better chance, especially somebody like Roderick Strong. And Roderick Strong is a great wrestler, don't get me wrong. But if someone like him were to come up to the main roster solo, he's going to die a death. He will die a death on that main roster, unless he's attached to a larger group, which is why him being in this group was perfect for him. It was the best thing that ever happened to him. the best thing that ever happened to Roderick Strong was being added to the Undisputed Era. So to break these guys up and then call them up, I think would be a mistake. Dominic, I keep wanting to call him Donovan Dijak because it just sounds like a better name, but I forgot he was put into the rebranding machine. Dominic Dijakovic killed a dude dead with a big boot. 6 seconds flat, that was it. Match was over. Then he took the microphone. He cut a promo about his family being the reason why he's even here in NXT. They gave him the opportunity to be here by immigrating to the United States, and now he has his eyes set on the North American Championship. And I saw some people this week who were at the tapings say that his promo, when you see it, guy, his promo was cringe, total cringe. So I read that, and I was expecting something cringeworthy. I was expecting something terrible. But I watched this, and it wasn't great. It was not great, and clearly promos are not this guy's strong suit, but it wasn't terrible. I thought it was fine. I mean, what wasn't so fine was him tweeting out the stuff about the streets being flooded with dirty people and all of that, which he since deleted because people thought he was channeling white nationalist propaganda, and he tagged a whole bunch of world leaders and Trump and all this in his tweet, and it caused a whole shitstorm, and so he deleted the tweet, and for a while he took down his entire Twitter account, which I think might be back up now. Now, I saw what he posted. I saw the screenshot before he deleted it. It didn't read as anything different than a heel doing the tired old anti-America foreigner shtick that we have seen so many times before. You would think, based on some of the reaction here to that one tweet, that this guy was a fucking Nazi or something. Like, get over yourselves. I agree, it's stupid, but it's stupid for a different reason. It's stupid because it just read like tired old anti-America foreigner bullshit that we've seen in wrestling going back 30, 40 years, 50 years. I remember when Ludwig Borga did the exact same thing. He was walking through the streets and talking about how filthy all of us Americans were. It's just, it's dumb and it's dated. Hopefully that was just him doing that on his own and not a sign of some new gimmick that they've foisted upon him. Donovan Dijak does not need to be Ludwig Borga 2.0. Kairi Sane against Shayna Baszler. Stipulation was that if Kairi loses, she can never again challenge for the NXT Women's Championship. That should have been a dead giveaway that this was going to be it for her in NXT. Good match. Kairi did a dive off the apron at one point that Shayna dodged, and Kairi's elbow struck the guardrail. Shayna worked the arm over for the rest of the match, to the point where the referee had the doctor come down to check on her. Io Shirai ran down to check on her friend. Shayna reached outside the ring, grabbed Kairi, dragged her back inside, was threatening to break her arm when Io ran in to make the save. But in doing so, she also cost Kairi the match and the chance to challenge for the championship ever again. And the rest of the horsewomen yanked Io Shirai out of the ring. They forced her to watch as Shayna Baszler did the arm break spot on Kairi. I actually think Shayna Baszler against Kofi Kingston, she probably would be a lot tougher in that match than Kofi would be. But she did the arm break spot on Kairi, send her off on her maiden voyage to the SmackDown roster. And it would also seemingly be the setup for an Io Shirai match with Shayna for the championship. She might be her next challenger. But it kills any follow-up to them, the whole story of Io costing, even though it was by accident. She cost her friend not just the match, but the right to ever again challenge for the championship. I think that could have been interesting. I don't know if one of them would have had to have gone heel, but we will not know how Kairi Sane feels about that because she has been shipped off to the SmackDown roster. So I thought on the whole, a good episode of NXT. And if nothing else, go out of your way to watch that match with Velveteen Dream and Buddy Murphy, because it really was the best thing on WWE television all week. So last week, I gave my thoughts on the first two Viceland documentaries that are part of this Dark Side of the Ring series that's airing on Vice. I talked about the Bruiser Brody, the Killing of Bruiser Brody documentary, which is airing this week. I watched it because they put it up for free on YouTube before the series debuted, so I watched that one. I enjoyed it, sad as that story, and as angry as it made me to kind of have to go through that story and hear about it all over again. It was a good episode. I think the strongest one yet of the ones that I've seen. I watched the one on Macho Man and Elizabeth. I didn't learn anything new. I thought it was fine, but it was, kind of a letdown a little bit because I was hoping there might be more in there I hadn't heard before, and there really wasn't. But, whatever. It was fine for what it was. And before I get to the Montreal Screwjob, which was the latest one that aired on TV this week, I was able to get access to watch the Gino Hernandez episode. Now, this one does not air on TV until May 8th. But I was able to watch it, and it's really good. It focuses on his death and the mysterious circumstances around it. Gino was a star in the world-class territory back in the day, in the 80s, in the early to mid-80s. A lot of people had him pegged for greatness. They had him pegged for bigger and better things. He was only 28 years old when he died. For years, some of the wrestlers were convinced that he was murdered. I think Michael Hayes is one of them. They're just convinced that Gino Hernandez was murdered. And initially, it was ruled his death was a homicide. It was, or not ruled a homicide, but it was a homicide investigation, I should clarify. And ultimately, the cops decided that it was an overdose. So that's how his death was classified. His own family, his mother, was interviewed for this special and believed that he was murdered. Now, I don't think this special, having seen it now, is probably going to change any minds if you already have an opinion about what happened. Or if you knew Gino or worked with him and you were a wrestler from back then, I don't know that this is going to change any minds. Was it an accidental overdose? Was it a suicide? Was he killed because he was involved in the drug trade? He certainly was hanging out with a crowd at the time of people who weren't exactly choir boys. I'll put it that way. But it's a fascinating watch. I don't want to say more than that and get into all the little details. I'll let you guys watch it for yourself when it airs in a few weeks. But it is definitely one that's going to be worth checking out. So I've enjoyed the series on the whole so far. I mentioned the Brody one and the Savage one. And then this week, it was the Montreal Screwjob. 22 years later, we are still talking about this damn match. Bret Hart was leaving. He didn't want to drop the title to Shawn Michaels in Canada because Shawn said he wouldn't be willing to do the same for Bret if he was asked. So Bret said, fine, I'll lose to anybody but him. I'll drop the title at Madison Square Garden to the Brooklyn fucking Brawler before I lose it to this man in Montreal. So they double-crossed him to get the belt off of him. WWE went on to great prosperity. Bret went to WCW, which ended up killing his career. Now he's in the Hall of Fame twice, and some reject and a Rasta cap recently tried to assassinate him. That's the Cliff Notes version of what happened. They interviewed Bret for this special. No Shawn Michaels. No Vince McMahon. No WWE cooperation, really, at all. They had Bruce Pritchard, but this is before he went back to WWE, I believe. He was there, Pritchard was, in the back that night at the gorilla position. Earl Hebner was interviewed. He was the referee for the match that night. Eric Bischoff, who added nothing to this. Scott Hall, who thinks everything is just one big work. I'm not even sure why he was interviewed, other than to get the contrarian point of view. Jim Cornette, who shared a big revelation on this show, which I'll get to. And Vince Russo, who was working on creative at the time alongside Cornette. And you know that anything with Russo and Cornette on it is just going to degenerate into something not suitable for younger audiences. So that's the setup to this here. Now, Bret agreed to do this. He was the star of the documentary. It was all about him, right? But it's gotta suck for him to still have to talk about this stuff because he said years ago that he finally came to peace with what happened. And yet he still gets asked about it all the time and gets comments from people saying, oh, he's so bitter. Why is he still talking about it? He only talks about it because he gets asked about it constantly. Is he supposed to have a smile on his face when he's talking about this? The only time he has a smile on his face is when he describes in detail how he punched Vince McMahon in the face and lifted him up off the ground. You could see how much he beams with pride when he tells that story, as he did on here. But back then, yeah, Bret took things very seriously. He compared the idea of losing to Shawn Michaels in Montreal to having his brains blown out. Which, in his book, You know, after he showed Owen a screening of his Wrestling with Shadows movie that came out, he said that that was the one part that Owen really took issue with and said he didn't like. And he reminded Brett what they used to say when they were first coming up, which is that nothing in wrestling is worth dying for. Which is just way too sad and way too eerie to think about when you consider how Owen died. But Shawn Michaels does not come across well and is not there to defend himself. And frankly, there is no defense other than to say, I was just doing my job. Because even Shawn Michaels would tell you that back then, he was a prick. Even when WWE had Jim Ross host a DVD with Bret and Shawn talking about nothing but the screw job, Shawn didn't really have a whole lot to say. And Vince McMahon's alleged defense to Bruce Pritchard when Pritchard asked him about it days later, days after the pay-per-view, because Bruce claims that he didn't know what was going to happen, and he was upset. He was pissed off that nobody clued him in. Vince, this is Vince's defense. Vince told him it was done as a, first of all, a favor to Bruce, because Bruce doesn't know what Bruce doesn't know. It protected him from anything blowing back on him, because he didn't know. And he also defended Shawn Michaels to Bruce by telling him that we all have Shawn Michaels to thank for saving our company and thus saving Bruce's job and his family, I guess, from financial ruin. Implying that Shawn, had he not gone along with it, bad things would have happened. But he did go along with it. He took a lot of heat for what happened, which he did. You know, Brett, I guess the idea that Brett would have waltzed into WCW with their championship, or WCW would have at least promoted the fact on TV the next night that they had signed away the WWF champion, and I guess the company would have ceased to exist, or something like that. You should be thanking Shawn Michaels for the sacrifice that he made. He's like wrestling Jesus. He nearly died for our sins. What a nonsensical bullshit argument. Pritchard also said, in describing things, that it was Brett's last night in the company. And that may have been what he was led to believe, but it was not Brett's last night in the company. That is a lie. And by no means am I saying that Bret Hart is some innocent casualty and doesn't bear any blame or any responsibility for anything that happened here. But some people have convinced themselves that this was his last match or his last night. He was still under contract to the company. For several more weeks, in fact, into December. He didn't even debut on WCW television until mid-December. It's not as though he would have been free to walk onto Nitro the next night. He couldn't, and Vince knew that. Maybe Bruce didn't. But that is just simply not true. Then there's Earl Hebner. I miss Earl. I miss those slow, dramatic counts he would make in those big main events. Made those matches feel more special than a lot of the ones we see today. I know some people hated when he would do that, but I loved it. Hebner's story is that he was on the flight to Montreal when somebody who turned out to be Brett upgraded him to a first-class seat so he could sit next to Brett, and Brett could ask him if he was going to pull any funny business or if he would screw him over. And Earl swore on his kids that he would never backstab Brett like that, because Brett had his suspicions. Brett was not completely dumb to the idea that something like this might happen. Even Vader, backstage that very night, was telling Brett, don't put yourself in any submissions. Because Vader, you know, he worked in Japan and may have seen similar things go down. People were warning Brett. They were telling him, Brett's not a dumb person. He kind of, maybe in his mind, he rationalized, this guy's not really going to do something like that to me. But it's not as though he didn't think it or have people in his ear telling him to be careful. So he's out here on this plane here, upgrading Earl, according to Earl Hebner, upgrading him and trying to get him to make a pledge or a promise that he would never do anything like that. And Earl swore on his kids that he would never backstab Brett like that. Then as he's getting ready to walk out to the ring, Jerry Briscoe pulls Earl Hebner aside and tells him to ring the bell when Shawn puts him in the sharpshooter. And Earl hesitates and says, well, I don't know if I can do that. And Briscoe tells him, is Brett paying your salary? This is from Vince. This is what Vince wants you to do if you want to continue to work here and keep your job. And you could see him as Earl is talking about this, getting visibly teary-eyed as he says that he basically, it ruined his life. It still bothers him to this day, even though he and Brett made up a long time ago. It still bothers him to this day. No matter where he goes, he still gets chance of "you screwed Brett." I mean, hell, Vince McMahon was getting chance of "you screwed Brett" on TV this week in Montreal on SmackDown. It's a chant that has lived on after all these years. But he's so upset about this, Earl Hebner is. He sells t-shirts that say "you're damn right I did" on them. Are you kidding me? Hey, look, the guy is a, well, I was going to say he's a savvy businessman, unless you believe the story about why he and his brother were fired from WWE, then he's not so savvy. But he's trying to be a savvy businessman here. Sell t-shirts. But you know what? You can't be too upset if for years, and maybe he's still doing it, I don't know, but I was at plenty of TNA shows where he would be wearing that shirt and he would be selling them at the concession stand for 10 bucks a pop. So, you know what? Save your tears. He, too, is part of the "Oh, It's a Work" brigade. Or so he said. He was on Busted Open Radio this week talking about the documentary, Earl Hebner was. And he had Bully Ray questioning him about it. And he basically said he believes it's a work. So he's part of that whole brigade. Scott Hall was interviewed. I'm not sure why. He came across really badly by basing his theory that the whole thing was a work on two things. Number one, that the camera showed Brett spitting on Vince McMahon, even got a close-up of the spit on Vince's face and in his hair, and they lingered on it, and that if it was a shoot, they never would have aired that during the show. Well, of course, they never did air that during the pay-per-view. That was footage they had in their archives that they showed years later. So that's theory number one, debunked. Theory number two is that, well, if it was real, why would they show Brett painting the initials WCW with his fingers in the air? Again, that never aired during the pay-per-view. That was footage they had that was used after the fact, when they were either trying to pop a rating for a TV special or to sell DVDs. So if that's what Scott Hall is basing his opinion on, I mean, look, you can have the opinion that you think it was a work. He cited specific examples of why he believes that to be true. And when you cite examples like that, then it's a pretty flawed opinion. It is a flawed opinion when the two things you cite as evidence never even happened. And then there's Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette's big revelation that he was the one who initially pitched the idea and planted the seed with Vince McMahon for a double cross at Survivor Series. Now, it is and it isn't a revelation because Cornette has talked about this in shoot interviews before, but this is the first time I believe that he has not only said that he pitched the idea, but that he even suggested the sharpshooter spot as a finish, as a way out at the end of the match. He, in the documentary, cited the match in 1931 between Strangler Lewis and Henri Deglane, which also, coincidentally, took place in Montreal, the first Montreal screw job. Lots of screwing going on in Montreal, apparently. I wonder what the birth rate is in that city. In the second fall of that match, Deglane faked a bite mark on his body, which got Strangler Lewis disqualified, and he won the championship. So Vince put him on the spot in this booking meeting, in this creative meeting, and Cornette said, just screw him. You know what? Screw him. Let's screw him and take the title. And at first, Vince waved off the idea. He didn't seem too enthusiastic about it. But the seed was planted. And it just went from there. He claims he had no idea that Vince was actually going to go with the idea until he was in the back at Survivor Series, like everybody else that night, watching on a monitor. And he saw it happening in real time. He saw Sean step in for the sharpshooter, hook the legs, turn over. And at that point, he's realizing, holy shit. Because he thought that they were just going to go with some kind of a disqualification finish. He was either at the gorilla position or near the gorilla position. He saw Owen Hart and the British Bulldog. They were waiting for their cue. They were of the impression they were going to run in for the disqualification. So he sees them waiting, and that's what he's expecting. Then he sees Sean going for the sharpshooter spot, and that's when he starts to realize, holy shit, he's actually going to use the finish. And then he got the hell out of there. He joked that he even beat Earl Hebner and both Hebner brothers to the car because he didn't want to be around in case anything blew back on him. He didn't know if people knew or thought that the idea was his. Same thing when he got to the building for Raw the very next night, because there were a lot of very angry wrestlers. Mick Foley refused to even show up. He was boycotting the show that night. Cornette on his podcast a few days ago said that Vince told him to go call Cactus and get him to come back to work. Cornette didn't know what he was walking into when he got to the arena because he had no idea who knew what. So here's my take. Cornette may have planted the initial idea, and there is some debate even about that, that it was Vince who actually initially kind of floated the idea. He had remembered the original screw job where they had Moolah under the mask as Spider Lady take the title from Wendy Richter. Richter was making a fuss at the time about wanting more money in a new contract and was just at odds with Vince McMahon about it. And there's a story about Gorilla Monsoon coming to her at the Madison Square Garden the day of the show with a new contract in hand for her to sign. But she said, I want my lawyer to look it over first, and that's when they move forward with their screwjob plan. I don't know if that part, the monsoon part, is true, but there's one story that Vince, as being the one to initially mention the idea of maybe some kind of a screwjob when it came to Bret and Shawn. The point is, the idea was broached, and what I believe happened is that other people slowly began to get on board with the idea. Now, maybe Russo did too. Although Russo, in the very next clip here in this documentary, claimed that he was the one who came up with the double cross. I did it, bro. Okay, bro. It was all my idea, bro. After all these years, people have been crediting the wrong Vince with screwing Bret Hart. It was me, bro. I screwed Bret Hart because it had to be done, bro. It had to be done. Bret was being difficult. He didn't want to do the job and lose the WWF title. And I thought, it's just wrestling, bro. Okay, it's just wrestling. I also pitched for it to be a pole match, bro, so that when Bret climbs up to reach for the belt, I push a button in the back, bro, and the pole suddenly gets 10 feet taller, and he can't reach it. But we couldn't find the right pole, so we couldn't do it. Bro, it would have been great. Anyway, of the two, I never skip an opportunity. It's been a while since I've done my Russo. I'm a little rusty. But of the two, Cornette and Russo, however obsessed Cornette might be, not even might be, however obsessed Cornette is about Vince Russo, I believe Cornette's story over him. The devil is in the details. Jim Cornette has all the little details to paint the picture of what happened. He did a follow-up on his podcast that I listened to when I heard he was doing something on Montreal. I knew I was going to talk about this. I said, I have to listen in case he adds more information or whatever. I want to make sure I got it right. So I listened to the show that he did, him and his co-host, and he goes into more details of it. Now, only a handful of people. He only told a handful of people over these, however many years it's been now, 20 plus years, only a handful of people even knew that he had initially pitched the idea first to Vince McMahon. Dave Meltzer was one of them. And for years, Meltzer said that he promised that he would not reveal that person's name until they were dead. And after Cornette came out with it on the special, somebody tweeted to Dave and they said, hey, Dave, was Cornette the person that you were referring to all these years? And Meltzer said, yes, it was him. And I believe him. But I also think that Triple H bears responsibility in this as well. That's why I think you cannot just lay this at one person's feet. I think the idea was already there. Then Vince had his infamous phone call, conference call, whatever, with Shawn Michaels and Triple H a few days before the pay-per-view. Because by that point, the two of them were basically attached at the hip. And supposedly, as the story goes over all these years, Triple H spoke up during that call when it looked like maybe they were having second thoughts and maybe they were waffling, or Shawn was getting very emotional about the whole thing. He's all stressed out. And Triple H spoke up and said, listen, he said something to the effect of, if he won't do business, we'll do business for him. He's leaving to go to the enemy. He's leaving to go to WCW. We've got to get that belt off of him. And then it went from there. But Cornette on his podcast said it was just mentioned as a what if. It was a what if finish because Vince put him on the spot in this meeting. The only people in the meeting when this happened were Vince McMahon, Jim Cornette, and Vince Russo. And Vince put him on the spot. They were having trouble coming up with a finish. He dared him to come up with something. And he thought, what the fuck? He never uses any of my ideas, save for the Hell in a Cell stuff the month before with Shawn and Undertaker. He said he pitched the idea to Vince of creating this giant cage that engulfs the entire ringside area, which is an idea he got from, I think he said he got it from Mid-South or one of the, I don't recall which territory it was, but he cited the territory that he had gotten the idea from, and the idea for Kane to rip the door off its hinges when he made his debut came from an old angle, he said, that he saw with Kevin Sullivan that he remembered. Vince used those ideas, but otherwise, for all the time that Cornette spent in creative, he joked that Vince never used any of my ideas. But this one he uses. And the irony of it all, he said, is that as someone who always works so hard to uphold kayfabe in wrestling, he wasn't, like, you know, Cornette was not a fan of the curtain call. Even now, to this day, he goes off on any little thing that kind of exposes the business. He's gotten into Twitter wars with people like Joey Ryan, and it's comical at this point. Whenever there's some kind of spot like that at like an indie show, the first thing people do is they tag Jim Cornette because they know that it's going to just make his head explode. So he's always been like that. And the irony of all of this is that as somebody who always works so hard to uphold this idea of kayfabe in pro wrestling, that as someone who did that, he ended up being the one who did more with that one finish to expose the wrestling business than any other finish in the history of professional wrestling. And he was apologetic on his podcast to Bret Hart, who probably is hearing all this for the first time as far as him being the one to initially pitch the idea. He apologized to Bret. You know, he says, I didn't want to screw Bret. Bret was the one that I liked. He goes, I would have rather double-crossed Shawn Michaels and fucked him over. But the last leg of this documentary just turned into Jim Cornette and Vince Russo spouting off about one another, and it ended with Cornette promising to live long enough to piss on Vince Russo's grave. His wife knows, he has left her explicit instructions, that even if he is incapacitated and has to be wheeled over, he will piss on this man's grave. Well, he certainly has a knack for being colorful. I'll give him that. But I will say this, though, to harbor that much hatred for one person cannot be healthy. I know Cornette's lost a lot of weight over the years, but even still, for his blood pressure's sake, I don't see how just carrying all this hatred around for one person could possibly be a healthy thing. Entertaining? Yeah, sure. But healthy? Probably not. At the end of the day, I'll wrap up with this. Everybody involved bears at least some responsibility for what happened, but there is no one person in my mind more so responsible than Vince McMahon. He is the one who signed Bret to a 20-year contract. He is the one who put the clause in said contract that gave Bret reasonable creative control in his final 60 days. Reasonable is a funny word that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Probably not the smartest thing for Vince to agree to, but he did. He's the one who put the title on Bret Hart that summer. And then a month later told Bret, I can't afford to pay you anymore. Would you take a pay cut now and I'll make it up to you on the back end of this 20-year deal? I owe you one, pal. I owed you one, pal, Bret Hart, long before he ever did CM Punk. And Bret said no, wisely. And Vince said, well, I'm breaching your contract because I can't pay you. So I'm going to breach your contract so you can go negotiate with WCW. You have my blessing. Go talk to Eric Bischoff. He's the one who then went back to Bret a month or two later and said, just kidding. I can afford to pay you now. Now I have the money. But by that point, Bret was already talking to WCW. I don't even think the deal was done. Technically, he may have been able to pull out, but he was deep in negotiations at that point with WCW, and he ended up signing with them. And he is the one, Vince is, who booked the match between him and Shawn Michaels for the Survivor Series in the first place. The same Shawn Michaels Bret Hart could not stand. Claimed Bret did that he was willing to work with him, until Shawn made that comment about, I'm not willing to do the same for you. But still, Bret had no love lost for this guy. You knew there were issues between these two. The same Shawn Michaels that Bret got into a hair-pulling match with backstage a few months earlier. Yes, it was the biggest possible match they could promote. I know why they would want to do it. But he booked himself into a corner. He did it to himself. But boy, did it pay off handsomely for him in the end. But it's amazing to look back now at how much wrestling has changed in the 22 years since that match to even conceive of something like this happening now, today, is impossible. You have younger fans now who are probably listening to this podcast right now or who may just watch the Vice special and they have no concept of how this stuff used to be or why the championship was so important back then. Who probably look at that now and go, what a silly, stupid thing to get so worked up about. Like today, if Vince wanted the belt off Brock Lesnar, if Brock Lesnar was still Universal Champion and Lesnar refused, Vince would turn around and just announce that the title was vacant and he would make a new belt and nobody would bat an eyelash. And if Brock took the fruit roll-up belt to another company, I don't even think the stock price would so much as budge, let alone would the company implode or suffer some kind of mortal blow? It all just seems so comical now that such a big deal was made about this. But part of me misses that. This idea that the title, that the championship was so important and people took things that seriously. I miss that kind of importance. That things like that used to have in wrestling, because we don't have that anymore. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Much like Cam here from St. Louis, Missouri. In a recent interview, Becky Lynch was asked if there was a woman on the roster that can be on the same level of Hogan, Austin, Rock, and Cena. Her response was, "You're talking to her." I thought to myself, no way. But maybe Becky could be on the level of a Bret Hart from 94, Shawn Michaels from 96, Daniel Bryan from 2014, or even CM Punk from 2013. Hogan, Austin, Rock, and Cena not only sold a ton of merch, but you'd see their shirts not only at wrestling shows, but on the streets. I heard Bret in 94 did little to bring in numbers like Hulk. Shawn in 96 did little to help ratings increase against WCW and the NWO. And WWE kept going back to Cena as the focal point because ratings dipped when Punk and Bryan had the title. You never see their shirts on the streets, but they were pushed as the top guys during their peak despite the ratings dip. I never see the man shirts worn out in public and viewership is down. Yet Becky is clearly the top star in the company. What are your thoughts? First of all, to be fair to Shawn Michaels, live event attendance did increase with him as champion during that first run in 96 that he had. Now, he may not have helped ratings much, but you can't say that he was bad for business like you would be able to say for somebody like Diesel, who didn't do much for business in 95, although 95 was just a terrible year all around. I don't think you can pin all of that on Diesel. But that aside, could Becky be a Stone Cold or a Rock or a Cena? Sure, she could. Her mama told her that she can be anything she wants. She could be an astronaut if she wants. Question is, will she be? The answer is no, she won't. Nobody in their right mind would say that she is even close, that she even sniffs that level right now. Hopefully there is nobody out there who would ever make that kind of argument. Because you need to understand something. And I've said this before. We may never again see anyone in this company, male or female, on the level of a Hulk Hogan or a Steve Austin. That is just not how this company is set up to run anymore. It's not about the individual stars, it's about the brand. And they have multiple brands within the brand. I think the comparison that you make here is actually a pretty fair one when you say that she's a lot closer to a Bret Hart from 94. Although without Bret in 94, the company would have been in far worse shape than it was in. Without Becky, because the company is so cash rich and so much bigger than it used to be, and because they're so stockpiled with talent, more than they need, more than they know what to do with, they wouldn't be in dire straits the way they would have been back then. They would be just fine. If Becky Lynch, God forbid, she broke her arm, she broke her leg, had needed surgery, or was in a contract dispute and was taking time off or whatever, the company would not miss a beat. Business would not suddenly have this huge dip. It would just, it's like when Punk did the pipe bomb promo and talked about being a cog in the wheel, a cog in the machine. That's how it is now. And maybe you can find a few exceptions here and there, guys who really do have an impact on live event attendance and things of that nature. John Cena, when he really stopped doing the live events, apparently, you know, it was reflected in a lot of the numbers. Because John Cena was the last real difference maker, I think, in WWE. And so, it's not a bad comparison, but it's also not entirely fair. It's a different world now. It's a different company. And I just don't think the environment that they have created, let alone a lot of the creative decisions that they make, especially because of those decisions, it doesn't make for a situation where somebody like a Rock or a Steve Austin could flourish today the way they did back then. You know, WWE has some big stars, but ask yourself this question. Are they really as big as the biggest stars of the previous generation or the generation before that? Or era, call it generation era, call it whatever you want. Are the biggest names today as big or bigger than the biggest stars of yesterday? I know the company, I mean, the company may have more fans now because they reach so many different parts of the world than they ever did before. And people have more access to the product because of the internet and because of Wi-Fi and all of that that just didn't exist when Hulkamania was running wild for the first time. But do you really honestly think that Braun Strowman is a bigger star or as big as Hulk Hogan? Is Becky Lynch as big of a name, or even close, as Stone Cold Steve Austin? Is Seth Rollins a bigger star than even John Cena was when he was at the peak of his popularity? And Seth's had as many, maybe more years now on the main roster than even Cena had when Cena was even at that level. People forget, you know, the Shield debuted at the end of 2012. It's 2019. Those guys have had a solid 6-7 years on the roster. And now Seth is the main champion. Would you say he's a bigger star than John Cena was when Cena was at his peak? The answer is no. They're not. So I know why she would say that. And that's not what she was saying. She was answering a question. I'm just saying, I know why she would say that, because what else is she going to say? And she may believe that. Because when she's the one that goes out there and gets mobbed by fans and gets the great reactions that she still does get when she walks out on TV and she sees the love on social media and she lives it. She lives it every day. So she may be in, maybe she's in a bubble and actually believes this. But when you start dropping names like that, it's not even a male or a female thing. There just is not, there isn't a male star on this roster right now, active full-time roster, who feels anything close to as big of a deal as those guys did. You know, you can throw Brock Lesnar's name out there, but he's not a full-time part of the roster, but he does still have a special aura to him. But take him out of the equation, who else is there? Now, Becky, you could say that she's pushed as the equivalent of what those people would have meant to the company at that time or what they would have been at that time. But when you start using terms like on the same level, maybe if she's standing on stilts, but it's just not going to happen. Sean in Corpus Christi, Texas. I'm going to whisper this question like the crowd's there. What do you think of Dustin Rhodes being announced as Cody's opponent for the AEW show next month? I kid Corpus Christi. Great people there. Cody and Dustin. Yes, that was a big AEW announcement yesterday on their Road to Double or Nothing YouTube series. They dropped the news in about five or six minute video. They had an on location shoot at his home with Dustin Rhodes, who is either about to become a free agent or is officially now a free agent. His contract is about over with WWE, and he has been announced as Cody's opponent at Double or Nothing, May 25th in Las Vegas. It's going to be brother versus brother for the first time since the one match they had in WWE back at the Fastlane pay-per-view in 2015. And back on the 28th of last month, so almost a month ago now, about 3 weeks, Pro Wrestling Sheet posted a news item that Goldust was soon going to become a free agent. And they said that multiple sources told them that Goldust's WWE contract recently expired. He's currently waiting for his non-compete portion of the agreement to run out. Now, that's a little confusing, because when a contract expires, there shouldn't be a non-compete. Like, if they let you go early or you try to quit or anything like that, they can keep you from going somewhere for up to 90 days. My understanding is that doesn't extend to contracts that just expire. Whatever the case is, they posted news that he was about to be gone from WWE and was going to become a free agent. And Dustin went on Twitter, and of course he ranted and raved and talked about smart marks. This is false, totally false. And as we see now, it turned out to, in fact, be true that he was about done. He was finishing up with WWE. And here we find out that he is going to be at the AEW show. I thought the video with Dustin was well done. They have a story, clearly, that they're telling. He went into how he and his brother, they are 16 years apart. They are two very different people. He feels that there's some bad blood. There's a rift there that he's not quite sure where it comes from with his brother. And they're building up this sibling feud for this match at Double or Nothing. Now, the one match they had 4 years ago at that Fastlane show, you know, for years, the two of them wanted to work a match together or a program together. I think they wanted to have a WrestleMania match. And it's a little puzzling why they did that match at Fastlane and didn't save it for WrestleMania that year. But they did it at Fastlane, and they laid an egg. The crowd didn't care. Goldust won with a crucifix pin that looked, I don't remember if it was botched or the referee was confused. It didn't look good. It was a flat finish, if not a botched one. It was a flat finish. It was a disappointment. It was a big disappointment to a lot of fans. That was Goldust versus Stardust. Now it's 4 years later. It's not Goldust against Stardust. It's Dustin against Cody. No gimmicks. No WWE agents telling him what to do. You got 10 minutes. Here's the finish. Go on out there. Now it's Cody's show, and it's one of the feature matches on this show. I won't call it the main event, but it's one of the big matches now that they're going to be promoting between now and May 25th. Cody is a bigger name to this audience than he was 4 years ago. You don't have to like the guy, but you'd be a fool if you didn't think that his name and profile were a lot bigger and a lot higher now amongst, you know, a lot of the hardcore wrestling fans than it was 4 years ago when he was doing the Stardust gimmick. And they're going to have all the time they need to tell the story that they want to tell. That's the big difference between that match 4 years ago and this match coming up now. And you look at the card so far, Double or Nothing lineup. You've got Kenny Omega against Chris Jericho. That clearly is the main event. You've got the Young Bucks, who are now the AAA Tag Team Champions, facing off against Pentagon Jr. and Phoenix, the Lucha Brothers, which should be a hell of a match. You've got Cody and Dustin and the story they're going to tell these next few weeks going into that match. And that YouTube series that they do is very well done. They actually do a really good job, a better job in some cases than WWE does, of telling stories through their YouTube series. So those are the three big matches. And you also have Pac, the former Neville, taking on Adam Hangman Page. So those are the core matches. And I got to tell you, on paper, that's a pretty strong card. You know, if you have a knowledge of these guys and are fans of their work and fans of these people, you look at the matches they've put together so far, and I think it's a pretty solid card, not counting whatever they have planned on the undercard. They're going to have another battle royal. I'm sure, you know, they'll have a surprise or two up their sleeves. on paper, it's a pretty damn solid card that they have here right now. But I'm sure in their minds, this is the match that they're going to go out there and have that they probably would have preferred to have 4 years ago in WWE. Because that match was a big disappointment. And I think that they probably have a lot to prove. And they're going to go out there. Goldust now is 50 years old. And he's been hurt. He had some injuries. WWE never really brought him back to TV. But up until recently, he was still out there hanging with the young guys. You know, he may be very vocal on social media and say some things that I feel are very insulting to the fans. I'm not a fan of some of the things he said, as far as telling people their opinion doesn't matter, basically, and calling everybody marks and smart marks, and debunking news that turns out, of course, to be real. I don't expect him to have anything to say about that. But I would come on the podcast quite often and sing the praises of Goldust when he would go out there and he would be moving around at 47, 48 years old like he was at least 10 years younger. So unless he's really slowed down in the last year or two, and he's going to go out there and feel probably like he has something to prove, if he's able to physically go out there and do what he was doing even late into his WWE run, I think the two of them could have a hell of a match. Rob, in Indianapolis, I, for one, was happy that Shayna Baszler did not get called up because she deserves her own personal call-up sometime this summer. What are your thoughts on her coming up as NXT champion, or NXT women's champion, and beating Becky two belts to become Shayna three belts? Well, Jason No Belts thinks that that would be a clever way to get Shayna over as a killer when she gets called up. But here's the problem with that idea. That implies that they are going to keep both belts on one person, possibly into maybe even the early part of next year. Because if Shayna were to win them, then she shouldn't be losing them for a very long time. And I would not have anybody beat Shayna Baszler for a while after she debuts. And so I think, A, they're going to want a full-time champion on SmackDown once they move to Fox. And if they're keeping this brand split and they have two belts, then they should have two champions. The Becky two-belt stuff is cute for a while, but it's going to wear thin. They're going to have to split them again, I think, in the next few months. Probably by SummerSlam. You know, there were rumors last year that WWE was considering a Queen of the Ring tournament sometime this year. And I don't doubt that it was an idea that probably was batted around, and maybe it's on the back burner, maybe they decided against it, because I haven't heard anything about that since. But that was the rumor and the scuttlebutt at the time. I liked the idea when it was first mentioned of a Queen of the Ring, and I pitched the idea on the podcast of having one or two NXT women in the tournament, including Shayna Baszler, and using that as a way to debut her on the main roster and having her win and having her go all the way, which would then earn her the right to challenge the women's champion, let's say of the brand of her choice. I think the idea works even better now, because if they time things right, if they do a Queen of the Ring, the tournament happens, let's say, this summer, it climaxes in July, let's say Shayna wins, and she earns the right to challenge Becky for both belts at SummerSlam in Toronto. And what better person to go after Becky Lynch than Ronda Rousey's best friend? So Shayna's goals would be twofold: to prove that she's the most dominant champion in all of WWE. She still has her NXT title, let's say. And also to make Becky pay for what she did for getting one over on her friend at WrestleMania. Becky and Shayna, champion against champion, at SummerSlam, I think, would be a big match. Then after Shayna wins, she vacates the NXT women's title to focus on the other two, which they could split if they want to have one belt on Raw and one belt on SmackDown, but that's how you could establish Shayna right out of the gate as a credible threat and a big name on the main roster. Joey from Canada, Bruce Pritchard and Conrad Thompson are covering Backlash 2004 on their podcast this week for the 15th anniversary of that pay-per-view, one that featured the great hardcore match between Mick Foley and Randy Orton. Buy or sell on the better match for Foley, Orton at Backlash or his match with Edge at WrestleMania 22? It's a tough one. I'm going to go with the Orton match at Backlash. I'm going to buy on that and sell on the Edge match between the two of them. I just liked the match with Orton more from what I remember. And I haven't gone back and watched these matches in years. So it's entirely possible that If I go back and I watch these two, my opinion might change. Maybe I missed something or I forgot something. But from my recollection of both of those matches, I enjoyed the Orton one more. And I just remember it was such a, I don't know if comeback is the right word, a redemption in a way for Foley, because he had a very uneventful, kind of embarrassing to be honest, very end of his run. When they brought him back for the match at WrestleMania 2000, it was kind of a sour note, in my view, for him to go out on, as opposed to him retiring after the Triple H matches in early 2000. So for him to come back and to face one of these young bucks, and the Intercontinental Championship was on the line, it was the most hardcore IC title match in the history of the company, I think it's safe to say. But he went out there and he did the classic Mick Foley match. It wasn't a technical match. It was a brawl. It was a fight. He took crazy bumps. There were thumbtacks. But he was able to go out there and prove to people that he could still have that kind of match. And it was a great match for what it was. And it helped get Randy Orton over. It did something for Orton, I think, that they did with Shawn and Diesel in 96. So when Shawn Michaels won the championship at WrestleMania 12, his first match was with Diesel. No holds barred. Basically what would have been then the equivalent of a hardcore match at the In Your House pay-per-view. And it was the first time that we really got to see Shawn Michaels in that kind of hardcore environment or extreme type of match with weapons and chairs, and he was being choked out with the camera cord, powerbomb, one of the first big table spots they did. You know, Bret Hart got knocked through the table in his match with Diesel at Survivor Series in 95. A few months later at this show, Shawn took a powerbomb from Diesel at the pay-per-view and took this huge bump through the table. You know, now it's commonplace. We see that every week. We have table matches. But back then in WWE, we didn't see that kind of thing. It was almost like it was done to toughen Shawn Michaels up and in the eyes of the fans and show them, hey, this guy's capable of more than just being a wrestler. He can also be a brawler. He can fight. He can get dirty. He can use weapons. He can survive the onslaught from somebody bigger or nastier than he is. That's why they did it. And he did it again when he had the match with Foley later in the year. He hung with Foley. They had that great match at Mind Games. So I think here they were trying to do the same thing with Randy Orton. Randy Orton's the pretty boy. He's the wrestler. He's never been in a match like this before. He took that back bump on the thumbtacks. I remember him telling the story. He was up with his, he was probably married at the time, his wife. And he had one tack. And he was laying on it or sitting up. Probably not sitting on it. I would hope not. He was laying on it to get a feel for it, for what he was in for the next day. And he kind of laid on it gently, and it hurt. It fucking hurt. And I'm sure he wasn't looking forward to taking that bump at the pay-per-view, but he took that big back bump. He went for the RKO, and Foley, of course, countered it and slammed him on the tacks. And that image of Orton sitting up and having tacks sticking in his back and bleeding, you know, it's one of the great images, I think, of his career. But in the end, he won. He survived it, and he won. So they told, you know, they told a good story with it. And that built up over a period of months. It wasn't just some match that was slapped together. And Foley and Edge, look, that's not to take anything away from the match they had also. That was a great hardcore match. And also, both guys, I think, were out to prove something. Edge should have been defending the championship on that WrestleMania against John Cena. You know, Edge had just won the WWE title for the first time. He cashed in Money in the Bank. And there was a rating surge in the weeks after when he won the championship. That's when they did the live sex celebration with him and Lita. But it was something fresh. It was somebody new on top with the title, and it was reflected in the ratings. And then 3 weeks later, at the Royal Rumble, he tapped out and lost the belt back to John Cena. And I'm sure that bothered the hell out of him. They should have at least let him go to WrestleMania with it. Instead, he was wrestling Mick Foley in a hardcore match. So in his mind, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to steal the fucking show. We're going to go out there and we're going to steal thunder from everybody else. And they did. And they had a great hardcore match. They did the big flaming table spot outside the ring. So I think if you were to go back and watch both of these matches, if you like that style of wrestling, you'll enjoy them both. They're both excellent matches. I just would have to give the edge, no pun intended, to the Orton and Foley match at Backlash. Just liked it better. George from Manchester. In my opinion, Andrade, Ali, Ricochet, Aleister Black are all the future of WWE. The new Fortunate Four, like Cena, Orton, Edge, and Batista, all future champions. Of these four, who do you think will win heavyweight gold first? So out of Andrade, Ali, Ricochet, and Aleister Black, who will win heavyweight gold first? I'm going to go with Aleister Black. And if I had to rank them on who I think will end up with Universal title, WWE title first, I would say Aleister first. I would say Andrade second. Ricochet third. And Ali fourth. That's how I would rank the likelihood of who wins what when. But I think Aleister Black is the one. And you can see it in his entrance. You know, they added the sound effect. They have the thing where he, you know, kind of propels upward. And they have all the candles and the smoke and everything. You know, you don't have a big entrance like that unless they have big plans for you, I would think. I'm sure some of you now are going to point out to me guys who were a bust, who went nowhere, who had a big fancy entrance. But I think there's a reason for that. And plus, he's a talented guy. He's very, very good. And he can speak, you know, all the things that are so important to them. So I think Aleister's going to be the first one. Kevin, in Albany, watching Monday Night Raw, when they did the backstage scene with Reigns and Rollins, it looked to me that Roman Reigns was the star. The Universal title itself looked too big to be on Seth Rollins' shoulder. Since today's wrestlers are smaller than those of the 80s and 90s, should WWE change the size of their title belts? The WWE Championship looks fine when wearing them, but many of the talent prefer to carry them over their shoulder, and unless they are 230-plus pounds, they just don't look like they belong holding the title. Any thoughts, or am I an idiot for thinking about this? Well, Superstar Graham, let me answer your question. No, I don't think you're an idiot at all. I think it's a fair point. As the belts have gotten big, and they have gotten bigger. I mean, these belts are gigantic. The wrestlers have, in many cases, gotten a little bit smaller. I think something the size of the original Winged Eagle belt would be perfect for guys like Rollins and Styles and Balor, and it would still look good on people like Strowman and Brock. It's not like it would look bad on them. You know, they did a photo shoot a couple of years ago, maybe more than a couple of years ago, on WWE.com. They went into the storage facility or warehouse, whatever, and they dug up some of the old title belts, including the Winged Eagle, and they had current roster members posing with the championships. So you had pictures of Roman Reigns with the Winged Eagle belt. And I even said at the time, he looked good wearing that belt. It worked for him. Maybe it was the black vest going with the black belt. I don't know. But they had him holding it, and Kevin Owens was holding it. Dean Ambrose was holding it, and it looked good. So I think that something like that, or the size of that, would look great on those guys. The WWE belt now looked, you know, it would look pretty big on Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels back in the day too. And they were on the smaller side. Balor with the IC title now looks fine, but that's because it's the older design. They didn't blow it up. It's not like the IC title on steroids, where it's four times as big as it used to be. If they blew it up two sizes, the belt would be around the man's ankles. Let's see. We'll end with this. Major from Virginia. Me and my 8-year-old son are sitting here watching the empty arena match during halftime heat between Mankind and The Rock. Buy or sell on Rock versus Mankind on Halftime Heat, or this year's Halftime Heat, with Aleister Black, Ricochet, and Velveteen Dream against Adam Cole, Johnny Gargano, and Tommaso Ciampa. That was a great match. Most watched match in NXT history. You can watch it on YouTube. Great match at Halftime Heat this year. That said, I'm buying on the empty arena match. I am selling on the NXT match. Much like my answer before, I just really liked that empty arena match. I was more entertained. If you're looking for pure straight-up wrestling, then by all means, go for the NXT match. It was great. It really was. But the empty arena match, I still to this day, when I go back, I watch clips or I watch the full match every now and again. If I can find it online, I just start watching it. And it's entertaining as all hell, in part because also Vince McMahon was back doing commentary for that match. And he had long stopped doing commentary in late 97. So here we are now. I guess it wasn't that much earlier, but here we are over a year later. Empty building. Rock and Mankind doing their thing. And Vince, who of course, you know, Rock was his corporate champion. He's very much in favor of The Rock. But he's still, if you listen to his voice, he's still doing old school Vince McMahon commentary, which I loved. Because I happen to think, even though he didn't know the names of a lot of the moves, that Vince is underrated by a lot of people when it comes to his skills as an announcer. But I just thought it was a very, just a fun match to watch. It was different than anything we had seen before in WWE. With those two guys, those two characters at that time, Corporate Rock and Mankind, always, who's constantly making weird noises and moans and groans and stuff, and his head was all bandaged up from the match they had at the Royal Rumble. At one point, Rock punched him, and Mankind went rolling down the stairs, which looked very painful. Then they brawled to the concession area on the concourse, and they went to the back, and they were hitting each other with giant bags of popcorn, and Rock found some salsa and chips, and he dipped the chip in the salsa and said, "Ah, it's mild." And and then there was another part. Oh, what was the other part? Oh, he picked up a fruit of some kind. I don't remember what it was. Some kind of melon, maybe, or a squash. Maybe it was a squash. But he looks at it, he goes, "I don't even know what this is." And he hits him over the head with it. They ended up in one of the offices, and everyone goes running, screaming out of the room. The phone rings. Rock picks up the phone. He's answering the phone in the middle of the fight. He goes, "Oh, Mankind can't come to the phone right now. He's got his mouth is full of The Rock's foot," and he kicks him in the head. And the finish was very goofy with the whole camera on the forklift and everything, but it's just fun, man. You just go back, and it's a fun match to go back and watch. And yeah, if I had to buy or sell, you put me on the spot. I'm buying on that one. I can't sell on that. I mean, it was just, it's too entertaining. So I have to buy on that one. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name. I always say that. And where you are from, it will help your chances if you want to try to get your question on the show. I'd like to know who I'm hearing from and where the hell you are from. I know you're from Earth. You don't have to say Earth. I need to know what part of Earth. And don't tell me the Northern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere. Don't worry, I'm not going to track you down. You don't have to be worried. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. Don't forget, if you are interested, they are airing the Shield special live on the network tonight, WWE Network, 9:30 Eastern. I guess I'll talk about that next week, although it's a house show. I don't expect anything too eventful to happen. So that's tonight. I will be back next weekend. That will be episode 597 on our road to 600. Solomonster sounds off here, year 12, still going strong. And thank you all, as always, for the support. Be well, stay safe. I hope you continue to enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Should WrestleMania be expanded to 2 days? Is it time for a 2-day WrestleMania? Fuck no, that's not what needs to be done. We didn't need a 2-day WrestleMania the first 30 years. We sure as fuck don't need one now.
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.